When I was living on my own for the first time, I had to go to the store and get milk and paper towels. And that was the first time I was like, wow, I am such a freaking adult. I really appreciate the childhood my parents were able to give me. I'm really privileged to have grown up in a functional house where my parents didn't want me to die. I made a parent stories video a little over a year ago, and I rewatched it to make sure I didn't repeat any topics. And all I'm gonna say is those stories and animation are not worth 10 million views. That video, I don't like it. I don't like that video. My parents were really, really big on manners and being polite. We've got some Asian blood in us, so we can't bring dishonor to our family. We'd do all the typical things, like call adults Mr. and Mrs., ask to be excused from dinner, make sure to thank everyone for everything ever, bow to our superiors. When my mom had new people come over to the house, she would make me introduce myself and shake their hand. And then when no one was looking, she'd pull me aside to a different room and quiz me. What color are their eyes? That was my mom's training course to get me to be good at eye contact, because I guess I used to be stupid and not look at people when they talked. But I remember that kind of backfired because I'd be so focused on memorizing their eyes that I wouldn't pay attention to what they were saying. Hi Jaden, how are you? Ah, alright, loser, I've got a quiz to take. Now that I've got 20 years of aced eye quizzes under my belt, I'm an eye contact wizard. I graduated top of my class in eye contact. I've got eye contact master's degrees. Well, every once in a while, some people make me nervous and I get shy. But other than that, I'm an eye contact powerhouse. I realized more recently that I think sometimes I go overboard and just end up staring at people by accident, and it's very weird, and I'm sorry at everyone. My mom would also be really strict on me saying pardon all the time instead of what. Like, she would say something I didn't hear and I'd go, what? And she'd stick her head around with, pardon? I wouldn't be a bimbo and be all, what? It's not like I was being a rude moron. One time, my friend told me, Jaden, I think you're the only person I know that says pardon. And like, that's all fine and dandy. I could respect my mom's request to use an underused polite word. But I can't. Because she's even worse. This is what she does. Mom, did you put my book somewhere? Huh? Objectively speaking, a what is exponentially better than a huh? I started mocking her whenever she did it, and then she gradually stopped bothering me about saying pardon. Also, I realized I never told you that I had a lisp as a kid. My parents meme on me about it all the time, and a running joke in the family came from when I used to be babysat by my mom's friend, who's Italian, which means she'd talk like this and have her house full of a spaghetti, and oh mamma mia. I'm only half joking. She's very Italian. Yahoo! She would make pasta for me all the time, and whenever she would ask what I wanted for lunch, I would pathetically go, pasta with no sauce! I wanted pasta with no sauce. And now, if my family would be having pasta for dinner, someone would end up going, I don't have a lisp anymore. Sometimes it shines through when I talk too fast or get sloppy with my words, but somehow I fixed it by myself. In first grade, we were learning about letter pronunciation, and when we got to S, the teacher explained that some kids say S with their tongue, when it's actually supposed to be behind your teeth. And I was like, oh. So I stopped doing it. Cured. Who knew that if you've got a speech impediment or some sort of hindrance or obstruction in your life, just stop it. Simple.
You've got cancer.
No, it's okay. Just stop it. When I was learning how to swim, my mom and her friend, who also had a daughter my age, hired a swim instructor for us. And I don't remember a single thing about it, except that she made us hang off the edge of the pool and just shimmy across the side. But I was terrified of these filters against the side and always refused to go across them because I was scared of being sucked in or something. I don't know how I passed that class because I refused to do the exercise. But at least I knew her eyes were blue. And then at the end of each lesson, she'd give us a piece of licorice, like we were dogs.
I didn't like licorice.
Oh yeah, and also this one time, I almost drowned and died. So my parents were having a bunch of their friends over, who also had kids, for a pool party. There were a handful of pool toys, like blow-up dolphins and beach balls, but we also had this floating foam mat. I was doofing off doing my own thing, and at one point when I was underwater, the mat drifted over top of me. When I had to go up for air, I hit the bottom of the mat, and I was like, uh-oh. Time for advanced critical problem solving.
So if this mat is over top of me, I can't get up to the surface to breathe. So what do I do?
I got it. I'll simply become a child Hercules and lift 3 6-year-olds from underwater into the air with my twig arms. Rather than using one of my four brain cells and swimming 2 feet to the side away from the mat, I decided to try and just bench press my way to survival. One of the adults realized I was being an idiot and also dying, and instead of being like, well, survival of the fittest, he dove in and saved me. So I didn't end up drowning of stupidity. Thank you, Mr. Chad. And now I'm here, on my own, moved to California, in my own place, not dead at the bottom of a pool, staring at everyone. Being honest, I love my family so much, and they've done so much for me. It takes a lot of effort to raise a person. Just think about how helpless and stupid babies are when they start out. They can't do anything. You can just put a baby on the ground and do nothing. Just leave it alone, and it'll just... pathetic. I'm so thankful and lucky my family's so supportive about everything I've been able to do, because I know not a lot of parents are like that. They even helped me sell merch at VidCon. They were so happy about it too. They came up to me after every day like, oh my gosh, Jaden, everyone's so wonderful. The people who watch your videos are so sweet. Someone asked me to sign their shirt, so I just wrote Jaden's mom. I was really nervous to pursue this career path because it can be a bit unpredictable, but the fact that they're so proud and encouraging has helped me do so much more than I ever would have thought I could if I was alone. So thanks, Mom and Dad. My mom put me in a lot of extracurricular activities when I was growing up, like I've mentioned before. And one I haven't talked about yet was the summer camp called Camp Operetta. When I was the ripe age of 8, my mom decided I wasn't enough of a versatile super child yet, and it was time for me to dip my toes into the showbiz puddle that is musical theater. I did piano and stuff, but I've never been interested in the performing arts. So when my mom asked me if I wanted to do this Camp Operetta thing during the summer, I was like, okay. Wait, what is this? Look, I just agreed with anything my parents told me as a kid. I didn't know I could actually have an opinion. I'm assuming that most of you don't know what Camp Operetta is because I googled it and got no results. To be fair, it was a one-off indie camp one of the local elementary schools just did. So, basically Camp Operetta was for young artsy theater kids and would start off by sitting in a group and reading a picture book. Then everyone works together to rewrite it into a musical play to perform in front of the parents at the end of the camp. And then what should the tiger say? Make him say the F word. Then we all get assigned roles for the play, write the music, and make the costumes and set. It was actually really fun, and I looked forward to it a lot. Also, when I say write music, I mean the teachers tell us how to play nursery songs on xylophones in those colored plastic tubes. We weren't dropping fire in fourth grade. The first year I did Camp Operetta, the book we were supposed to theaterize was... I can't remember. I just know it was about a bunch of animals in the jungle, and I wanted to land the role of cheetah because I thought cheetahs were cool. And obviously, I'm the best cheetah out of all you losers. She wasn't the main character, but I've never been a main character kind of guy. I'm the I can't cope with number one spots because the expectation, spotlight, and stress is enough to break me kind of guy. So that's why I'm always happy to sit at, like, number two in most things. It proves, hey, I'm talented and hardworking enough to land an important and high-up role without complete judgment and pressure of being at the top with everyone waiting for you to mess something up. Bit of a depressing life hack for you guys. Spoiler alert, I nailed the audition and reeled myself in the role of Cheetah. The catch was there were too many kids in the camp for the amount of characters in the play, so what the teachers decided we'd do was assign 2 people per character, and then halfway through the play, switch out casts. The girl who landed Cheetah 2 was this one girl who I don't remember the name of, but I thought she was super cool because she only had one arm. It's a good thing the teachers didn't care that the 2 kids who shared a role didn't have to look similar because they'd either have to dye her hair dark brown and make her look Asian somehow, or chop one of my arms off. We made masks out of paper plates, painted a jungle scenery on big sheets of paper for the background. I think the costumes were made of paper too. Look, they didn't have much money. I remember one day I decided I wanted to bring my favorite stuffed animal to camp with me and show him off to the other kids. It was this stuffed mouse I got at a bookstore I named Raoul, spelled R-A-O-O-L-E, because that was 8-year-old me trying my best. I brought out Raoul during lunch/break time and we all started playing with him. We stood in a big circle and tossed him hot potato style to each other, and after a few minutes of this, I went to go use the bathroom real quick. Raoul's always been really special to me because he was the first purchase I made completely on my own without my parents' permission. At the end of the school year, if you read enough books and took a little test to prove you read it, you'd get to go on a field trip to a bookstore. And I, being the bookworm I am, barely scraped in by reading the bare minimum amount of books to make it. In a desperate attempt to make the cut in time, I even requested a bunch of random book tests. In some miracle, I'd guess enough answers right to pass and get points for. It was pathetic, and it worked.
Hell yeah, suckers! I totally earned this trip! Woo!
The purpose of the trip was for kids to get excited about reading and buy some books they'd read over summer break. So I walked around the bookstore, looked at the books that people were talking about, skimmed the new releases, and then bought a mouse because I don't like reading. And I was really excited about it because it was my first 100% own personal choice. I didn't have to go, "Mommy, can I get this?" I made my own decision. With their money. Since that field trip, I took Raul everywhere, and he's always been my favorite stuffed animal and super special to me.
Hey, we ripped his foot off.
So in the literal 2 minutes I was gone taking a pee, the kids got so rambunctious that they ripped Raul's foot off, and all the frickin' beans were spilling all out the gash hole.
What the frick, you barbarians!
I immediately put Raul back in my bag, upside down, so no more beans spilled out. But I wasn't really that upset about it. For some sixth sense reason, while I was in the bathroom, I actually thought to myself, they're gonna rip him open somehow. And they did. I was cool, and we were all able to joke about it. The beans that spilled out looked like little eggs, so we were like, oh, he's laying eggs, ugh. After camp, my mom was able to stitch him back up, too, so he's all good. Look, here he is, doing good. Anyway, we kept working on the play, finished getting the show set up, practiced our lines, and after a couple weeks, we were ready to perform in front of the parents. And I think it went really well. I honestly don't remember anything about it, but my parents are sending videotape footage they took of it, so here's some of that. But that's not the end of Camp Operetta. I went again next year, and this time we did a play on the rainbow fish. The story of a special fish with shiny rainbow scales, and no one wanted to hang out with him because he wouldn't give them what makes him special. And the only way he felt like he could be happy was to give away his specialness to the fish that only wanted to leech off his beauty. Setting aside the controversial morals of the book, we got to work turning it into a play. There weren't as many kids this year, so we didn't need to share roles. I ended up, again, with a semi-main character. The seahorse. Now, hardcore rainbow fish stans are probably saying, wait, there's no seahorse in that story. And you're right. As a group of kids, we decided to completely create a new character in the story because we liked seahorses. And that was the cohesive moral story about acceptance and loneliness.
Can we add a seahorse? Make him say the F word!
During the music learning part of the play, the teachers asked us who could play the piano because they wanted to assign someone the role of playing the Under the Sea melody from The Little Mermaid without botching it up. I, along with three other kids, raised our hands and we were taken to the piano to do a little musical audition. The other kids took turns playing Mary Had a Little Lamb and Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and I quickly realized I was overqualified for this part. When it was my turn to play, I sat down, and played Pachelbel's Canon I memorized from my piano recital, like a show-off. That was the one time I realized I was the Asian kid in a scenario. I got the part. The night of the play, we got into our costumes. Mine was made out of a towel with the bottom rolled up to look like a seahorse tail. I thought the costume was actually really cool, but a problem arose when I was in the middle of my final lines in the performance. I had a solo part where I was supposed to build hype for the ending of the play, then raise my arms up at the end to deliver the lines that induced the big finale. But as I was saying my lines and getting ready to raise my arms up, I realized the bracelet I was wearing was caught on one of the towel strings. I started freaking out because this was the big finishing move for my character. It said in the script, "Seahorse raises both arms, blah 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 blah." This was the big moment, and it's gonna be ruined because my costume is a towel. I was wiggling my wrist in all directions and trying to get my arm free as time was ticking down quickly. Finally, I delivered the last line and could only raise up one arm. Like Cheetah 2. I remember feeling really stupid because no one raises one arm to do anything but ask to use the bathroom. Or be flamboyant. I felt like I ruined the big moment, but talking to my parents afterwards, they said they didn't notice, and looking back, it was probably a much bigger deal in my 9-year-old's head than it actually was. I still feel like that was one of my biggest failures in life, though. See, that's exactly why I don't like main roles in anything. A prime example of self-fulfilling prophecy. And that was my time in Camp Operetta. No, I didn't do it a third year, because they didn't have enough money or participants, so they had to shut it down. I told you they didn't have much money. You will be forever missed, Camp Operetta. You made my summers more fun, and my Raoul's foot all janky. I've played a lot of Pokemon in my days, and by that, I mean, I've played the same Pokemon game with various different skins. But I'm here today to showcase one of, if not the most unique ideas for a Pokemon game Nintendo has published for our tiny little hearts. And that game is called Pokemon XD Gale of Darkness. XD. A bit unfortunate, but it came out in 2005, so they get a pass. Why am I talking about it? I think it's an underground game not enough people know about. It does something different, kind of shakes up the formula. It's constantly overshadowed by its predecessor, Pokemon Colosseum. And yeah, okay, I played it as a kid. I'm very biased. Is that what you wanted? If you've not heard of it or played it, you're in for a treat today. The game opens up to a cargo boat, the SS Libra, out at sea, where we find the captain and guy who steers standing at the helm. All is calm and serene when suddenly they get swatted. And it's not no ordinary SWAT today, folks. No, sir. This is a Lugia SWAT. They run out to see what's going on, and the captain looks up and makes this face as if he wants to kiss Lugia passionately on the lips. But Lugia's not here for kisses. He's here for the opposite of kisses. Which is crime. He hyper beams the cargo ship and then steals it. You heard me right. Just blasts the thing point blank and takes it away. Lugia's ship now. The presumably only two people on the entire boat fall into the water and are left to just drown in the ocean, I guess. Well, that was a bit raw. What are we, a minute in and two people are dead? Gen 10 could never. Hard cut to me, because that's more important. You play as this boy kid named Michael, but actually his name is Jaden now, because that's me. The game throws you into the middle of this intense looking fight between a Salamence and Metagross, both level 50. I don't know where I am, what the stakes are, who I am, but this battle seems really important and tough, so I'm gonna give it my all and immediately Oko it. I did it! Screen goes black. I open my eyes, everything's blurry.
Wake up, Jaden, you've been in a coma for 15 years.
Turns out I live in a friendly laboratory run by this Professor Crane and his lab guys. I get up and the guy running the battle simulation tells me how good of a battler I've become. Aw, thanks, man. Then he immediately negs me by telling me it's about time I go out and get myself more Pokemon besides my one lame Eevee. Backhanded compliment at a child, but I'll take it, I think. I go into Crane's office where him and my mom are talking, and he says he heard from the battle coach that my battling skills have improved dramatically, and how proud he is of me. To which my own mom tells him to stop giving me compliments and praise because I'm gonna end up spoiled rotten. I don't know what kind of a response that is to a child receiving praise. Either I'm already a cocky little bastard, or I'm being currently emotionally neglected by everyone in this building. Whatever it is, I don't think it's healthy for my mental development. To make this mother look even worse, we realize her only other child, Jovi, is missing and no one is looking for her. The world is only filled with overpowered wild rabbit animals and crazy people. No, I'm sure it's fine you haven't started looking for her. Keep doing what you're doing. I get a lead saying she really likes hanging out with family friend mad scientist Dr. Kaminko, so I head over to his house and I'm about to knock on his creepy door when this tiny little blind man, Chobin, the doctor's assistant, walks up and is like, "Burglar!" and challenges me to a battle, to which I win because he only has a level 5 Sun Kern. Jovi comes out and is like, "Oh, hi, big brother, it's Jovi. Did you get lost, big brother? Silly big brother, Jovi will guide you back home." Alright, I see why no one is looking for her now. We return home to the lab, and they present me with a snag machine. A machine that allows the user to catch shadow Pokemon, which are Pokemon that have been so abused that they turn evil. Now, they're saying they haven't seen or heard of any shadow Pokemon that exist anymore because they've all been purified years ago, but who knows when they could start popping up again? Better be safe than sorry! Bam! Some guys from a secret organization called Cypher bust into the lab, beat everyone up, steal Professor Crane, show off their shadow Pokemon, and run off to their secret base to never be seen again. Well, I'll be. The lab is in shambles, not knowing what to do, but then decides they're gonna complete their purification chamber in his honor because shadow Pokemon are back and they want to do something about it. They send me off to this seaside town, Gadeonport, to retrieve a machine part they need, and Jovi pesters our mom to come with because Jovi doesn't think I can handle going out on my own, and Jovi needs to hold my hand and guide her big brother the whole way. Okay, not only does this little snot talk in the third person for no reason, maybe our mom didn't care enough to get us any education. Perhaps she was worried the teacher would give us a compliment, heaven forbid. But she's also the most annoying character I've ever witnessed in any media, and I've watched an episode of My Hero Academia with a grape kid in it. We go to Gideonport, and not 2 seconds pass until Joby pisses off this random guy, Zook, who happens to be the buffest man in the world. He's about to punt her, and I'm about to do nothing about it, when this old man and his color-coded henchmen step in and obliterate his Shadow Zangoose. Old man, I was about to be free of everything that is bad in my life, and you took that away from me. We get the part, head back, and Mom tells me about this spot in Agate Village called the Relic Stone where you can naturally purify Pokemon. I don't know why you're making your own purifying chamber then when there's a rock that already does that. I go to Agate, and this very enthusiastic man with a Pikachu shows me the stone, and I'm like, cool. To which he's like, by the way, my friend Vander might know where Cypher took Crane. Oh, okay. I go talk to Vander and he points to this random spot in the desert on my map and is like, oh, they're right here, I saw them. What were you doing out there? That's literally just sand. Wow, would you look at that, a headquarters. Huh. I start infiltrating the base, battling all the grunts that fall from the ceiling, snagging any shadow Pokemon I find, until I reach Pink Hatsune Miku, who's trying to get information out of Crane about purifying shadow Pokemon. I battle her and win, which means I get to unkidnap him, and while heading out, I find this data ROM on the ground. Huh. This seems very important and like it has a lot of secret information about Cypher on it. Convenient. Crane returns to the lab and everyone's happy, and then they send me to Pyrite Town to find Ned, a guy that should be able to crack the ROM and access all the information on it. So I head there and he's like, yeah, we can crack this, smile. While he's hacking it, I go out and play around in a random cave and run into Mirror B. This guy doesn't do much in this game, honestly, but I just want to make sure you know he exists and listen to his music. I go check on Ned again, and Cypher's bustin' beat everyone up and kidnapped another person. Have you guys min-maxed how to kidnap people or something? You're 2 for 2 at this point, and are scarily efficient at it. They tried a hostage situation the data ROM back, and even though I beat up this big man and take all his shadow Pokemon, Ned still wusses out and gives the ROM back. He thought he was being 2 steps ahead because he saved all the information on his server already, but Cypher just logs on and deletes everything anyway. Ned says the only thing he remembers from the ROM was that Cypher was behind the disappearance of the SS Libra, and they're about to attack this city nearby called Fennec, and someone needs to go warn them. I guess I'm just Mr. Scooter across the desert and save everyone today, aren't I? I head to Fennec to warn the mayor about the attack, and as soon as I arrive, this lady hits me with a confetti cannon, congratulates me on being the millionth visitor to the city, and shoos me away to celebrate at Real Gam Tower. I try to get around her because this is important, but she's determined to gatekeep me no matter what I do. So I just go there and realize she literally sent a child to illegally gamble his life away. Wow! No one in this region likes children, do they? After not being able to figure out how to play bingo, I head back, sneak into the mayor's house, distract his house sitter with music, and find out the mayor was trying to write a note to Justy, the city's gym leader, warning him about the Cypher attack. I don't know why the mayor was trying to ask this random gym guy to help, but he was kidnapped halfway through writing it, so I guess it doesn't matter. Cypher realizes I now know what's up, and everyone in town reveals themselves to be disguised Cypher grunts. Oh my god, they kidnapped the entire town. I don't care what kind of organization you're from, if you can successfully kidnap a village, you've earned my respect. I beat up Cypher, rescue their shadow Pokemon, and free literally everyone in the town who is locked in the city basement. Justy says he saw something suspicious going on in the desert and points to another random sand spot on my map I should go investigate. Honestly, how are all these people just stumbling onto these shenanigans in the middle of the desert? And why are they able to give the latitude-longitude of these locations after finding them? This has got to be like tens of miles out from any sort of civilization. This is where people run out of gas in their car and then shrivel up and die before anyone can find them. Why were you here? Wow. Yep, that's the cargo ship. How did you find this? All right, what is so enthralling about this desert that crime and vigilante justice is constantly going on in every square inch of this place? Cyphers running around on the ship, and after I take their shadow Pokemon and chase them out, this group of strangers calling themselves Team Snag'em walks up and roofies me. I wake up, realize they stole my snag machine. This random old man who just started living in the wrecked boat said he saw them head off in that direction and points to the middle of nowhere on my map again. You people are beyond me. I show up and wow, another headquarters for crime. I make my way to their head honcho, Gonzap, who's trying to put on my snag machine, but he's too big and muscular and adult, and since I am a child, it does not fit on his giant muscle arm. He pretty much gives up, asks if I want to join Team Snag'em. I say yes, but he fights me anyway. And after I beat him, he's like, actually, you can have your arm thing back. We're not enemies. Awesome. So why am I here? You drugged me, stole my stuff, and then just called friendship and gave it back. I find Cypher's Shadow Pokemon Factory and walk up to the actual biggest men I've ever seen in the world. How naive I was to think Zook was big. Foolish me. Anyway, they're about to beat me TF up when Gonzap shows up, expresses his devotion to our newly blossoming friendship, and roofies them for me. Thanks, man. You're really consistent at that. I go inside and climb to the roof where their power generator is. There's a tiny little piece of paper there that says, use system lever to adjust voltage. Do not raise voltage too high. Crank! A guy comes out and starts yelling at me with his Pokemon when the tiny old man who accidentally ruined my life in Gideonport comes on screen and's like, I'm evil and creating a Pokemon that's unpurifiable! Come get me! This is my IP address! I need to cross the ocean to get to him because he's basically on evil Hawaii, so I take this Robo Kyogre from Kaminko, speedboat my way there, and you guessed it, fight everyone in the building slash volcano until I get to the big little man. After fighting an entire country's worth of people, I find him. His name's Grievel, by the way. And he's like, I'm surprised you made it this far. Ha 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 ha. Well, I'm busy, don't bother me. And blocks me with a giant pane of glass. Honestly, out of all the fictional villains I've seen, this is surprisingly decently reasonable. But I'm not gonna just sit here and stare at him behind the glass like a goldfish at PetSmart. So I just walk around and use the side door, which really sets him off. I mean, dude, either lock the door or don't have it. This is just what doors do. Grievel's like, you blew up our shadow Pokemon factory, you got past my glass. That's it, I'm summoning Shadow Lugia, the first Pokemon to ever be unpurifiable. Come forth and obliterate this small boy. To which I just Master Ball it. Really overlooked that one, didn't you, mate? He may not be purifiable, but he's mine now. Huge L. Grievel gets so beyond pissed that he decides to open his creepy eyes and fight me himself. And I was surprised to realize not only does he have a team of all shadow Pokemon, but he somehow nabbed Articuno, Zapdos, and Moltres. I'll be honest, it was a really, really hard fight because shadow Pokemon are super effective against all non-shadow Pokemon. I don't know how it took me this long to tell you that, but that's how it works. So instead of trying to catch them all like I've been doing this whole time, I really just beat them up and they ran away. So I win! Cypher has officially lost everything, and it's all because of me, the little boy. Blue henchman runs up to Grievel and is like, sir, I have a plan. Let's blow up the island with the kid on it. Which is like, oh my god. And then red henchman is like, okay, that's a bit too far, man. Dad, let's go home. Yeah, they pulled the I'm your father slash son twist on us. But it has very little effect on me because I do not care about these people. Anyway, they decide to not blow up the island with me on it and stop being evil, I think. I'm like 60% sure. And then, happy ending, I just go home. So what do you think? For some reason, I really liked the game as a kid. I never actually beat it because I didn't know how to get past the gatekeeping woman in Fennec. Glad I figured it out this time. I also wanted to mention how lively the animations are in this game. Sure, some of the Pokemon look god-awful. They gave Houndour human knees that bend forward, but they're all just so expressive and show so much care and personality. It may be pretty sad the current games don't show this much passion, but I guess that's just what makes these games more cherishable. Anyway, the game was fun and weird. I liked it. See ya.
You already know Mario. I'm not gonna explain Mario to you. But a lot of people don't know about a little Mario community that thrives in the depths of the deep, dark Mario crevices. I'm talking about Mario Kaizo. Mario Kaizo is basically fan-made high-difficulty Mario. People will take base games like Mario Bros. 3 or Super Mario World and rearrange the levels to look like this. As you can see, a little more tricky than normal. I've been casually watching Mario Maker and Mario Kaizo content for a few years. I just think it's fun to watch while I'm eating cereal in the morning. And then one day I just stood up and was like, I want to do it. My favorite Mario content creator is Ryukar, so I DM'd him asking if he had any Kaizo recommendations that are, you know, beginner friendly. I mean, I'm naturally gifted at video games, but it's Mario Kaizo. I need a beginner little baby card over here. Cut me some slack, alright? Ryu asks if I've played any Kaizo hacks before, and I'd say no. And then he asks if I've ever played any Kaizo levels in Mario Maker before, and I'd say no. And then he asks if I've ever at least done a shell jump before, and I go, I've played Hollow Knight, and he goes, I don't think that can help you here. And I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. After a few more messages, Ryu generously offers to train me for Kaizo before I jump straight into a complete ROM hack, and oh boy, that was extremely nice of him. And extremely needed. We hopped into a Discord call, and as I screen shared the training ROM, he was able to give me tips and pointers of what to do and how to do tricks. So I opened up the first stage called the Simple Jump, and...
Alright, so this level seems like nothing. It's literally called the Jump, and it's...
Are you picking up on what I'm about to be dealing with here? Anyway, throughout the session, I learned about getting past chucks, getting past reverse chucks, how to deal with lava plants, what slow and fast fall is, balancing on disco shells, precise swimming mechanics, grabbing and jumping on this block thing at the same time, it's weird, shell jumps, you know, the basics. I was steadily getting more familiar with the moves and learning everything, and I'll be honest, I was starting to feel pretty good. You know, kind of getting the hang of it now, bit of a confidence boost. And then I hit the test stages, where all the mechanics you learned are packed into, like, an actual level. Test 1 wasn't too bad, it looks like this, and ended up taking me around 20 minutes to beat. But test 2 was the one that got me. It's a short, fast-paced level with no checkpoints, but... between the really difficult button input to do the block grab jump thing, straight into a shell jump, and then land on Tiny Dino Man onto Yoshi, my armpits were sweating. The last trick you gotta do is ditch Yoshi and win. But since I bonked my head or missed the jump so many times, you can see the trauma behind this hesitation here. But I ended up getting it after an hour and a half of attempts. After all that, Ryu says he thinks I'm ready for the real deal, sends over the ROM he recommended, and here's my experience trying to beat my first Mario Kaizo hack, Super Ryu World. This is how the game starts out.
You're doing great.
That's fair. So, level 1. I'll be honest, pretty straightforward. Jump on a few guys, do some more jumps, choke right in front of the checkpoint.
No.
Oh.
But eventually I was able to beat it, and I'll admit, I was pretty stoked.
Does he jump too? Yeah.
Yes! I was worried I wouldn't even be able to pass the first level, and I actually just... couldn't make this video because I was too bad, but knowing I can beat at least one, yeah, meant more to me than it should. And the show goes on. Level 2 was ramping up. You run through and dodge various thwomps and stuff to hit a P-switch, then run back through everything in reverse so you can get into the pipe that was previously unreachable. After many attempts and this...
No, let me in!
I managed to slip my way into the pipe where I met these two friendly guys. I was really caught off guard by cats in Mario game. So caught off guard, in fact, that I just ran into them and died.
Checkpoint? Checkpoint? What? What is that?
Oh!
I beat the stage quickly after, so let's not... come on. Next was this really cool escort stage where you nab this Galoomba at the very start and use him to progress through the stage. It was difficult, but I had a really fun time with this one, and the atmosphere was really cool. But I guess I was having too much fun because I let my guard down and got real humbled. No! Also, the first time I got to that part, I thought the Galoomba would turn around and come back, but he didn't, so I just watched him walk off the edge and strand me. Anyway, I had a hunch the checkpoint was right after that pipe, so I knew that if I just got that jump right, I could start making more progress. And after like 30 minutes of trying to get back in there, I finally did. On the bright side, I was completely right about the checkpoint being there. I did not, however, calculate this.
So...
I did it!
You did it!
Please, a checkpoint. No!
I'll be honest, that was a good one. I couldn't even get mad. And it's even more funny when after you get the checkpoint, they'll spawn you right above that pipe continuously. So whenever you start again, you gotta immediately hold hard right.
Oh.
So yeah, I eventually ended up beating the stage. Now let me tell you about the fourth level. Moles. It was a lot of tricky maneuvers that didn't leave much room for error. Also, I thought the beginning was funny.
Oh, okay.
Trying to jump on these slippery little freaks was a bit rough. This was hard. This was hard. This was hard. I did this part wrong.
I think I needed him.
This guy suicided.
No, don't do it!
Oh.
And then it just got worse. The second part of the stage turned into a build-a-bridge mole escort mission. I'll save you all the pain and agony and just say this level, especially the second half, gave me the most hell compared to the upcoming levels for a while. Even more hell than the level called Jank Heaven. I don't really want to cover every single thing that happened in every single level, but I can give you a little taste of what Jank Heaven was like real quick.
Sorry.
That Mario sprite.
No! Shoot! That's a jump that's just hard. I think everything I do here is impressive.
To some benchmark, what? Yes. Oh. I'm glad you, like, had the awareness to do that. It's like, holy sh...
Oh! Shoot. This is the last jump.
So I'm progressing a good amount into the game at this point, but then I get to a ghost house called the Waiting Room. Overall, it was a pretty difficult all-in-one go level with no checkpoint, but the one part that just kept tripping me up throughout the entire stage was this part where you jump onto this wiggler, balance on him until that wall goes back up, jump off, and then whatever, do bomb stuff. I just couldn't do the wiggler part consistently at all. Either I would mistime the jump and pathetically hop off the edge like this, or do this, or this, but it was mainly the pathetic one. I would say probably 80% of my deaths happened on that part specifically, and it technically isn't even the hard part of the level. I really don't think that part was even meant to be that hard at all. But an hour and 30 minutes of doing the same mistakes over and over, just trying my best, I realized there was a much easier and smoother way to do that entire part, and I literally wasted all that time making the whole thing way more difficult than it needed to be.
Oh!
Nice.
That's so much easier.
Huge.
Oh my god, I can't believe I've been dying to that wiggler that way this whole time, and I could just do that.
It's probably what's intended as well.
You're probably right.
Yeah. I mean, once I learned that, I beat the stage 20 minutes later. That was awesome. Am I upset? No, not really. I'm an animator that works in Adobe Animate/Flash. I'm used to throwing away multiple hours of work into the trash. By the way, this happens right in front of the goal.
Ah, okay. Dup, 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 dup.
Be cool, be cool, be cool.
You f***er. I love... I did not...
Jaden.
The stages are getting much more difficult at this point. There's only 4 worlds in the game, each containing around 3 or 4 levels, which going into it, I didn't know. I thought there was gonna be a full 8 worlds and I was starting to sweat in world 3. But yeah, Ryu ended up telling me I was in the home stretch, and I popped off so hard. I just thought I was bad this whole time. After a few more levels, pain, agony, I made it to the last world. And oh my god. World 4, Stage 1. was the worst thing this game ever ended up throwing at me. I don't even know how to go into detail with all the tricks and moves you need to do in this stage, but I spent 4 hours on it. An hour and 40 minutes on the first half, and 2 hours 20 minutes on the second. I know Mr. Beast and other content like that has kind of changed people's perceptions on how much is a lot of time in terms of YouTube content. 4 hours is nothing compared to, I don't, 24 hours touching a worm, but I sat there making mistake after mistake, learning and adapting and still failing for 4 hours straight. It was starting to like get to me, like personally. Eventually, every time I would mess up, I would feel it in my insecurities. Ah! I have no confidence in my own judgment to make important core decisions! But I did it. Again, 4 hours later. Maybe you don't think that's a long time, but I was wallowing in my own personal hell there for a while. So knowing that was the very first level of the last world, I was suddenly very afraid of this game and what it'll do to me. But surprisingly, the other two levels weren't nearly as bad as the first one. I ended up finishing stage 2 in only an hour and a half, and stage 3 in 30 minutes. That was the ego boost I needed to regain some strength again, I'll tell you that. Stage 3 boosts my confidence, and stage 1 keeps me humble. Fair and balanced life, if you ask me. Then I realized I was about to enter the last level. Dude, I'll be honest, I was mad proud of myself. I went from not even knowing if I could build enough skill to beat one level to getting ready to go into the final level of the entire game. Ryu hopped into a call with me to be there for the finale, which basically meant he sits there for an indefinite amount of time watching me fail over and over on mechanics he's already mastered. Like watching a toddler struggle to fit the circle block in the square hole. In good old Mario Kaizo fashion, the level starts out with, I'm gonna miss this when I come out victorious. Or just perish on the spot, either way. So I started chipping away at the level, jump on these guys, balance on Spikey, do this, do that. I was a little bit nervous because Ryu was watching and I wanted to show him how much I've gotten better at Kaizo. You know, like a teacher finally being able to see their student face their final fight to the death battle. Well, like, not just some school teacher, like a cool samurai teacher or something. I messed it up. Anyway, I was trying to impress him, and then I just went and did this, and this, and this. But he seemed proud of me anyway for just being able to get this far. I was making some good progress on the level. I was about to get to the final checkpoint, but, you know.
Right?
No, jump. I knew it! Things happen. Even though it was a really hard level, it was still surprisingly a lot of fun. And not nearly as bad as 4-1. I keep bringing it up, but it really got to me. But like that, maybe a bit less than 3 hours later, I got to the final room. It's boss fight time. For a final boss in a Kaizo hack, the fight was actually pretty chill. Not easy, but you chill. These on and off switches control the room going up and down, and you gotta get the floor low enough to grab these little blue blocks to throw at the giant King Boo or whatever he's called in this game. But don't let it get too low because then you can die to the lava right beneath there. So you're trying to keep all these things in mind, but to add to the pile, these little flying boogers meander around the stage while you gotta dodge them. And yes, they're RNG based, they're random, you can't just memorize their booger pattern and be on your merry way.
Whoa.
Okay, the smart way to go about this boss is to stay in the middle and calculate safe times to go to the sides and hit the switches. But I was being stubborn and trying to brute force my own way to do it. What a little booger.
Those guys are
strong.
He punishes you for standing on the edges, you know?
I'm gonna stand on this edge.
You're like, I don't give a shit, I'm doing it anyways. In the lava and then crushed.
And then, oh, this edge. Oh, as is life. Oh! Okay,
wonderful.
I'm gonna stand on this other side.
Yeah, it's, kind of is, actually. Except for the guys that come out of the wall and kill you. But it's pretty, like,
I'm gonna die on this hill. I didn't know how many times you have to hit Boo. Mario rules always default to 3, but it's Kaizo, so it could also very much be 1,000.
They know.
No!
Oh!
Ah! Oh! Okay, so now I know you have to hit him, like,
I assume 5 times. Oh.
I'm not gonna spoil how many times you have to hit him.
Yeah, so I hit him 3 times and didn't win, so I was like, alright, must be 1,000. But then a few attempts later, this happened. Huh. Oh my god!
Oh snap!
So I did get him 3 times, and you then did, I just then you died too quickly.
Isn't that awesome?
It was 3. I just died too soon after that 3rd shot, and it didn't count, which I'm going to choose to ignore. I did it! I learned Kaizo, and I beat Kaizo. And it only took 17 hours, not including training. Are there much more difficult hacks out there? Oh, yes, absolutely. Some of them look so disgusting, I don't even want to be in the vicinity of their aura. But I was able to challenge myself and beat one that was really well suited for my skill set going in. And looking back at some of the things I was able to end up pulling off makes me feel very cool. Look at his stuff. I did that. It's cool, come on. I want my hard-earned credit and applause, please. I think my favorite thing about Kaizo is how easy it is to visualize the progression of your skill within every single level. Like, World 3 Stage 3 starts off with a really difficult maneuver that I got hung up on for a while, and then suddenly I'm nailing it almost every single time. You can really feel and see yourself grow within Kaizo, and I don't think you can say that about a lot of things. Does that mean I recommend you try it? Absolutely not. If you get impatient and frustrated easily and are also bad at video games, don't even think about it. But hey, if you think it looks interesting and you can stay calm under extreme circumstances and have around 17 hours to kill, I can't recommend it enough. I liked it. Thanks to Ryu for helping me out and being extremely nice and training me and giving me a great ROM and literally just sitting there watching me struggle for many hours. Go check out his channel. He's very entertaining. I've been watching him for years now. And yeah, that's it. I'm officially very good at video games and I have supplied documented proof.
A while ago, I went to the bank to get a new debit card. I walked in, the lady asked, "Can I help you?" And I said, "I'd like a new debit card, please." Her face scrunched a bit, and then she replied, "Let me see what I can do. Would you take a seat for a moment?" I sat in the lobby chair for 30 minutes, assuming that she was doing everything in her power to get me a new debit card. And when the lady finally came back, she simply said, "No, we don't do that." You're the bank. For the longest time, I've been tossing around this little thought. I don't know if it's just me, but it kind of feels like the world around us doesn't quite work anymore. At least compared to, say, a decade ago, it seems like everything has gotten less efficient and, dare I say, stupid. Anytime I go out to get something done, I come back 3 hours later with nothing accomplished and a fresh desire to punch a wall. I've tried to gaslight myself out of it. Maybe I'm overreacting here. Humans have always been flawed creatures, so of course it's doomed to bleed into the construction of our society. But I just keep thinking back to those 30 useless minutes in that bank chair. And I simply don't believe it. You're not gonna convince me that a bank has always been incapable of giving people new debit cards. And also that it took 30 minutes to tell me. Something has changed. It really dawned on me when I watched the Always Sunny in Philadelphia episode Dennis Takes a Mental Health Day, where Dennis tries to have a normal, relaxing day, but is faced with inconveniences at every corner that spike his blood pressure. Highly recommend watching. The whole show is phenomenal, but that specific episode was so real and truly made me process things are getting less efficient. And it's not just in my head. First of all, like the episode addressed, everything needs a goddamn app now. The thermostat, air filters, light bulbs. I bought the cats a new automated litter box, and guess who now has a litter box app on her phone to get it to even turn on? I'm sick of the stupid apps. They don't make life easier no matter how many times these products try to convince me they do. The UI is always clunky and confusing. Nothing is optimized. Companies act like you can part the Red Sea with their apps, when more often than not, I'm stuck trying to connect it to the device in the first place. When was the last time you bought a new anything? thing and had it completely set up and working within 5 minutes of unboxing it. At this point, if my Wi-Fi goes out, every electronic in my house becomes a useless block of metal because none of it works on its own anymore. Everything needs Wi-Fi, an app, an account linked to my email, a subscription service, and on top of it all, they sell all the information I hand over against my will to random other companies so they can send me stupid junk mail! Also, when did unchecking the sign me up for online newsletters and discounts just not work anymore? Every single time I buy something online, I make sure to not sign up for the website's stupid email notifications. And what do I find fresh in my inbox when I wake up the next morning? Check out this month's wacky deals. So I have an electric car, right? One day, it just straight up refused to play music. After troubleshooting for 5 minutes, it turned out I needed to download a software update to my car, even though the music worked perfectly normal before the update. Sure, fine, the future's now. But for some reason, the car couldn't find or connect to the Wi-Fi. So because of that, I get to experience LA traffic in pure silence. I spent thousands of dollars on a car just for it to randomly not be able to perform a task cars have been able to do for the past 70 years. I do like electric cars, they're better for the environment, and it's great not having to go to the gas station. But let's not pretend the car has to be a computer now. I got one of those modern tech cars that made the innovative choice to remove all the physical buttons and knobs and put every single basic feature into the car's giant touchscreen. Before getting it, I didn't think that would affect my experience too much. I thought, well, when I drive, I normally don't fiddle with the buttons all the time anyway, but now I have to deal with things like not being able to manually open the glove compartment because it has no latch. I have to speak into the car microphone, "Open glove compartment," and every single time it opens the charging port. Didn't think about that one before buying. Also, when I do need to do something while driving, it feels way more unsafe than I initially realized. They didn't even build AC knobs, so to turn up the air, I have to essentially play on the car iPad while paying attention to oncoming traffic. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm neither an engineer or car specialist, but that feels stupid. Apparently, enough people started complaining about the lack of buttons in high-tech cars, so they started putting them back in, which now puts into question these experts making these decisions in the first place. What do you mean thousands of people had to say using a giant iPad while driving is unsafe? Before, they were like, you know what? These people might be onto something. A few weeks after I bought the car, I accidentally stepped on glass and needed to go to urgent care. So Jacob and I hopped in, and as we started driving down the neighborhood, the screen got covered with "Software update required!" Thinking it was a simple fix, Jacob pulled off to the side of the road and clicked download, to which the car completely locked and became undrivable until it finished the download, which was 45 minutes. I ended up having to call an Uber to go to urgent care, despite owning a fully functioning car. Lesson learned, I suppose. They got me again. Also, I don't know how a car can download a software update on the side of the road and not in my own goddamn garage. It all just feels so dumb. Nothing feels like it's checked to make sure the customer has a half-decent user experience anymore because companies think slapping an app together makes something high-tech enough to get away with slop. And on top of it all, everything is a subscription service. Why can't I simply buy my stupid computer car and have it come with the tech that's already built into it? Subscribe to be able to connect to the internet. Subscribe to enable auto steering. For a while, companies were thinking about turning the seat warmers into a subscription. The heating coil is already in the car that I bought. Just leave us alone. Imagine pitching to someone 15 years ago. Oh yeah, the car you bought? Yeah, it's all yours. But you have to pay money every month to use the windshield wipers. It's become so common for us to buy products and not even actually own them, and you need to pay money every month to keep using them. And they're bad! Businesses have always prioritized profit. That's never changed. I'm not upset about that. But at least in the past, they had to, in good faith, offer something that actually did the shit it was advertised to do. Now they just go, oh damn, we can give less and charge more? Hell yeah, brother, lock the cold out the fridges! The other day, I wanted to get a new router for my office. Jacob and I headed over to our internet provider store, and I said, hello, can I buy a router? Oh, we don't actually sell routers here. You need to go online and ask customer service to send you one. As I was processing this, Jacob decided they wanted to get a phone upgrade. Excuse me, could I actually buy this phone? Yeah, we don't have those in stock here. You can buy it, but it'll have to be shipped to your house. We went to the internet and phone store and left with no internet and no phone. What are the employees being paid to do at that point? What's the point in any of it? I get that a lot of shopping has shifted to online, but I really, really miss simply having the option to go to the store. They're becoming empty husks with a logo on top. Also, excuse me, but I need to ask customer service to buy a router? Just let me exchange my money for the item that you very obviously sell. Anytime I'm told I need to contact customer service, I consider it a lost battle. Nothing exists in this world that is worth descending the trenches that is a customer service phone call. Companies have put it together that if they make everything inconvenient and frustrating, set up enough cryptic hoops to make people jump through, waste as much time as possible, people will just give up. And they don't have to deal with anything. It's sick! Once I needed to call a plumber, but was only allowed to go through a very specific company for the service. So I called in, sat on hold for 40 minutes, as to be expected, and finally got connected to someone. Hello, what can I help you with today? Hi, I was calling to make a service appointment. Alright, sounds good. I'm gonna check our calendar and call back with our availabilities. Oh, okay. Thank you. And so I waited for 2 days, and she never called me back. So, of course, I call back, sit on hold for another 40 minutes, and try again. Hello, what can I help you with today? Hi, I'm calling to make a service appointment. I called before, but no one called me back, so I wanted to follow up on that. Okay, let me check. We're available in a month at 7 a.m. Oh, okay, are there no other times available? Nope. Alright, I can do in a month at 7 a.m. Thank you very much. Awesome. Exactly what I wanted. A month comes and goes, and the day before the appointment, I get a call from the plumbing company. Hello, I'm calling to let you know the person that was scheduled to do your service appointment is sick and will have to cancel it. Okay. When's the next available appointment? In 2 weeks? Okay. Thank you. At this point, I was fuming, right? How hard could it be to get a very specific company to provide a service they forced me to use them for? Well, get this! I woke up the next morning at 10 a.m. because I didn't have to wake up early anymore, looked at my phone, and saw a single missed call from, of course, the plumbing company. Hello, the plumber arrived at the location this morning at 6 a.m., but left because no one was home. Please call back to reschedule. Thank you. Guys, I can't even write into words what I was feeling that moment. Because if I did, this would be the last video of my career. A single service appointment is all I ask. For my sink that is dissolving at this point. Also, we're completely brushing over the fact they arrived an hour early for the canceled appointment, so I would have missed it anyway. And just like that, it was all back at square one. And you know what? I gave up. Congratulations, plumbing company. You won! The trophy? My sink is broken. I was justifiably feeling upset, so I wanted to go out and get myself those Pillsbury Halloween cookies with the pumpkins and ghosts on them, because it was the season. I looked online to see if the grocery store had them, and the website said, in stock, confirmed in the past hour. So I got dressed, drove over, and lo and behold, The store had zero Halloween cookies. I did the same charade two more times until I just went home and cried. What's the point anymore? Really? My car doesn't work. The stores don't work. The litter box needs Wi-Fi. I'm just so tired. We're doomed to be wrong of every single dollar we have. Cursed to scroll endlessly on social media because it's evil now. It's nothing good anymore. We're being left behind over here, and no one can do anything about it cares. I don't want to get too doomer in the silly animated YouTube video. Sorry, maybe a bit of reality started to seep in there between the funny little stories. Quickly, I'm going to talk about things that do spark joy in my life. There's been an influx of people going back to old tech as a way to step out of the overwhelming and predatory modern innovation era, and I am also on that boat. A while back, I started playing on my old 3DS, and something about using a classic handheld rewires my brain in the best way. Being all bundled up with your DS, no second monitor content, maybe some snacks, it feels like my mind gets to heal from the constant rot, cleansed from the addicting flashing colors and stimuli of current media. Another way I heal from the evils is by seeing all of my best friends. Truly going out and being with people in real life is the medicine that heals all, I'm not joking. No matter how much the world breaks me down, a good hangout with friends to vent and blow off steam really does take the edge off. And getting to turn annoying moments that piss you off into something to share with your friends as a funny story is a great way to laugh it off and just move on. I'm sure many other people have their own ways to break free from the ever-looming capitalist clutches, but overall, I've just been trying to go back to basics, depend on things less, not constantly overwhelm my senses. I think it's unfortunate that a lot of us have gotten to the point where we need to police ourselves in what we consume because everything is trying to be the most addictive little parasite ever created by humans with no empathy. But until the pendulum eventually swings back the other way, it is possible to break out of the bubble. And if you've been feeling similarly to me, I recommend giving it a try. In the meantime, even though everything feels like a constant mess, I suppose it does make for funny stories to share.
I'm not one to jump on sponsorship opportunities or promoting products. I get a lot of emails from companies willing to give me deals or money to mention their products in a video, and I've always turned them down because I don't think ads fit very well on this channel. But I recently received one opportunity that would be too good to pass up. Samurai Buyer. The reason why this email caught my attention is because I saw the YouTuber I Hate Everything get the same opportunity a while back. He made a really funny video about this and ended up having some fun with Misaki, who's the owner of Samurai Buyer. I suggest you go watch his video, it's extremely entertaining. If you stop by, tell him I say hi. So since Alex had so much fun with Misaki, I thought, you know what? Why not? I want to see what I can do too. And after sending a few emails and talking to Misaki for a while, I can conclude that I love this man. He's the most innocent cinnamon roll of a Japanese man who just doesn't know English very well, and I can't express how much he has won my heart. Misaki's gonna be watching this video because we're best friends, so hey Misaki, how's it going? I'm just gonna show everyone our emails and conversations, and I'll get right into the items you sent me. Thanks, dude. Love ya. Alright, so it all started when I got the first email here. My name is Misaki from Japan. We are currently looking for YouTube partners to work with us and promote Samurai Buyer. And he basically says he'll send me free items as long as I make a video about it. And I was like, alright, I understand that this man doesn't know English very well. Am I doing this? I'm doing this. Greetings, Sir Misaki. I am Jaden from United States. I am very in love with many of your store products and fantasize buying them on numerous occasions. I am quite honored that you desire to sponsor me with gifts from your shop personally. It makes me feel very special, and I hope I have made you proud, good sir. However, on my YouTube company, I do not create content of unboxing the merchandises. This is a problem, to say the least. Although I cannot produce a short film to upload for my people, if you send me a box of goodies, I am very willing to share with them on my social medias. Hope to hear from you very soon. Jaden Animations. At this point, I wasn't sure if I wanted to make a whole video about this, so I thought maybe I could get him to send me a box and I could just tweet out the crazy stuff he sends me. But oh, do I have some stuff to share with you guys about this. It would have been a crime not to make a video about what I got myself into. Just stay tuned. It gets crazy. Hello, Jaden. Thank you for your reply. I understand that unboxing video will not really suit your channel. However, we would like to offer you to make some tutorial video of how to use Samurai Buyer with your wonderful animation skills, which I personally like it. What do you think? Mizaki. Dearest Mizaki, oh my, that is a wonderful ideas. You are one brilliant man, Sir Mizaki. I am blessed to be in your presence via electronic mail. I would love to share your products to the world with my videos through the magic of motion of animation. How many items will you be sending? I want to be able to make a long enough video so that my kings will be satisfied with me. I want to make them proud of me as well. They are my happy. Harambe 1999 to 2K16. Jaden Animations. Hello, Jaden! I am reviewing your animation for past 3 days. I just like them. You can just tell me what sort of items you like to get. Maybe something like $120 at first. Mizaki. I didn't know what he meant by $120 at first. I thought he wanted me to send him $120 to have him ship the items, and I was like, no, I'm not spending $120 on this. Peace and love, Mizaki. I'm not sure what you mean by $120. Are you implying I send you money? I cannot pay money because my money goes to my dog that I have in my house. I have to pay him money to keep him happy. It is a complicated relationship. If you would send me the craziest and most insane things you have to offer in your shop, I will be a happy camper. I myself am quite crazy and most insane, and want to be blown away with the surprises you will be delivering to me. Wow! The more items, the merrier. Send me as many items as your company can. I can handle it. Don't worry. I accept the challenge. I shot the sheriff. Jaden Animations. And then he says, $120 for you to choose the items. Mizaki. That didn't really answer my question. Mr. Mizaki, am I paying for this? Or are you sending them for free? Just send me what you think I would like. I trust you, Senpai. Jaden Animations. And then he says, hello, Senpai! Senpai? Okay, I pick up the best items for you. Mizaki. Thank you very, very much, sir, Mr. Mizaki. I will make a good video with them. I won't let you down. Before I send you my shipping information, I have one question you must answer. How are you doing today? I am curious because you are a hard-working man and I hope you are doing well. I await patiently for your reply. Jaden Animations, Jaden Draws. Hello, Jaden Senpai. I am great, thank you. Anyway, you have Skype? Notice me, Mizaki. So, I'm guessing that since he's always talking to a bunch of other YouTube people who are also aware that he doesn't know English very well, they're saying things to him like, notice me, senpai, and he's picking it up and saying it too. Anyway, so I add him back on Skype and he says, hi, senpai. Oh, he makes me so happy. Then we chatted a bit and he asked if I could hop into a call. Now, I don't like calls. They give me anxiety. But I was like, you know what? I'll do it for Mizaki. So we had a nice conversation for like 10 minutes. I got to tell him I'm half Japanese, my mom's Asian, and my dad's white. And he's like, oh, we're similar. And then he started joking about rice fields? Is that racist? I don't know if that's racist or not. So now he's talking about rice fields and goes on to say, oh, you need to visit sometime and see. I mean, all jokes aside, Mizaki, if you want to fly me over to Japan, I am so down to come visit you since we're best friends now. We'll frolic in those rice fields. Just tip me up. And in the call, he also mentions iDubbbz. iDubbbz is a YouTuber who's also done a video about Mizaki and Samurai Buyer. His video is more PG-13, so if you're not into that stuff, you probably shouldn't watch it. Otherwise, he has a pretty entertaining video too. So Mizaki says, oh, do you know iDubbbz? You're both in the United States. I do not know iDubbbz, but come on, man, we're both in the United States. Why haven't we met yet? So that was the gist of the call, and he said he'd mail the items as soon as possible. So now I'm hyped. I'm excited to make this video. There's so much funny stuff I wanted to share with you guys, but wait, there's even more. He messages me again a few days later saying, are you there? And I was like, senpai, hey there. Oh, okay. I had some English question. Alright, we will be making banner on the top page of Samurai Buyer, like Pokemon, Dragon Ball, snacks, and Japan exclusive items. I am looking for the catchy phrase for each banner. Do you have any idea? Example Pokemon banner. Let's catch all Pokemon! Like a slogan for the entire website? And he goes, nope, on each contents. Banner. Ah! And then he says the categories again. So something I suggest can literally be on the official Samurai Buyer website, and I am freaking out. This just keeps getting better and better. I know what I need to do. Yes! What if for the Dragon Ball one you wrote, Dragon Ball, over 9,000! Over 9,000? Oh, power! Yeah, because in the show they say that. I am still open for everything. We do not have American staffs here, but we are selling items for American. Lol. I'll help you out, buddy. I love slogans. Thank you. Pokemon must go!
I swear to God.
I'm just sitting here watching this whole thing unfold perfectly right in front of me. How did I get here?
What about for the Japanese exclusives? For all your weeaboo needs. Ha 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 ha. Is it okay to use weeaboo? In the public? Like business? You're marketing for mainly the teen and young adults, right? They use that language all the time. Oh, okay. This was all at like 2 a.m. for me, so I was getting a bit too loopy. I told him I'd help him think of more tomorrow, and he sent me this cute emoji with a guy standing on a podium with confetti. So the next morning, he brings up the slogan again, and he still needed one for the snacks category. So I suggested, I'm hungry! Because when you want to eat snacks, you're most likely hungry. He seemed to like that one, and that was that for a bit. I didn't really give it another thought until I decided to randomly look at their website, which I actually hadn't done up to that point yet. And look what I find! He actually used my slogan for his banner! Legit, it's on his website, you can go see for yourself! That's mine! Oh my god. I got so many of those happy, excited tingles, you don't even know. He also used his Pokemon one too. Pokemon must go! I didn't come up with it, but I take credit for it because when he suggested it to me, I was like, yes, use that! Oh, this makes me happy. Alright, one more thing before we get into the items. When I was in the call with Senpai Mizaki, he asked if I could put him in the video, like animate him, and I was like, freaking heck yes, and asked if he would send me a picture of what he looks like so I can draw him. He didn't want to send an actual picture, I'm assuming for privacy reasons. Don't worry, bro, I totally understand. So I asked for a description of what he looks like, and he says, imagine a Japanese man, and that is what I look like. Now, Mizaki, you're gonna have to try a little harder than that. I asked him to elaborate, and he sends me this photo to use as reference. Okay, sure. I'm pretty sure this is a girl character from an anime, but you know what? We're a progressive era. This is fine. So everyone, this is Mizaki. Say hi!
What's up, guys? This is Mizaki from Samurabaya. Please call me as Weaboo Mizaki. Thank you. Please enjoy your wonderful selection of Japanese merchandise. See you later.
So, without any further ado, let's get into what Senpai Mizaki sent us.
So I got the box here. This is what Mizaki sent us. He wrote, welcome to Ricefield, Jaden. I haven't opened it yet. You can see it's still, like, taped up. So let's get into this. I'm excited to see what he sent us. Alright, so the first thing I see in this box is a Full Metal Alchemist figurine. I haven't seen the anime, but I know that's a spicy anime right now. Aww! Look, he sent little Japanese Pikachus! Aww, how precious. Mizaki. Aww, look, they can go with my Dragonite. Aww, that's adorable. Alright, let's see what else is in here. Uh-oh, we got ducks. What do you think, dude? Ari likes the ducks. It's strange that they were just, like, on the bottom. They don't have any packaging. But, okay. And we got a little Cyndaquil. Aw, he knows that I like Pokemon, so he probably sent me a lot of Pokemon stuff. Oh, my. Aw, this is, aw. Mizaki! Look at this! This is adorable. I've never had so many Pikachus. And then, alright, there's more ducks. There you go. And we got a little fan. Open it up. This is hard to do with one hand. Ooh, look how pretty! Ari, you need some fan? I think I know why he sent me so much Pokemon things. When he was talking to me, he was like, oh, do you like anything specific? And I was like, no, you can just send me whatever you think I'd like. And then he's like, oh, you like Pokemon, right? And I was like, yeah, I like Pokemon. And he's like, do you like plush? And I was like, yeah, I like plush. And then he sent all the Pokemon and all the plush. Mizaki, you're so awesome. It's like a big ol' happy family. There's the mom and the dad, and Ari is taking a child. Ari, no! No!
Halloween is coming up, and I feel peer pressured by myself to make a Halloween-themed video, so that's what you're watching. But when I sat down to try and think of something to talk about, nothing really came to my mind. I don't have any crazy Halloween stories or over-the-top thoughts about it. It's kind of just a meh holiday for me. Then I realized,
I have nothing to say about Halloween. So that's what this video is about. Reasons why I'm not the biggest fan of Halloween, but it's not like I don't like it. I'm just overall neutral about the whole thing. Please don't dislike this video. I always only hear about people either thinking, Halloween is the best holiday and anyone who doesn't think so can be sacrificed by goats. Or, Halloween is horrible and is just an excuse to make dumb skeleton puns and worship Satan. And I'm neither of those. The most I'll really do is reference the Halloween spoopy meme an unhealthy amount of times because that's really my favorite thing about the whole season. That probably explains very well the extent of my Halloween enthusiasm. The thing is, I'm willing to give Halloween a chance. I just haven't had any great amazing spooptacular things happen when I celebrate Halloween. So to all you huge Halloween enthusiasts, I don't know, tell me how to be more spoopy. See, yeah, it's pretty bad. I decided to cover some main Halloween staples and explain, I guess, why Halloween doesn't stand out to me. So hooray, let's get ready for some transition slides. You think I'm popular and outgoing enough to even be invited to regular parties? Who do you think I am, an extrovert? The majority of the Halloween-themed parties I've been to are those neighborhood parties where all the adults get together with their kids and everyone's got mediocre costumes on, and nothing fun really happens. Just small talk and alcohol for the adults and hyperactive kids running around being brats. I never know what to do at parties, so I just follow my mom around like an idiot. Sometimes people would be like, oh, Jaden, you've gotten so big since the last time I saw you. How's school? Literally. I think that's the only thing adults know what to say to us. And I can understand, because when I try to put myself in their shoes and think about what I would try to say to a millennial, I wouldn't know what to talk about either. So, do you guys still dab? Just kidding, that meme has been brutally murdered. Last Halloween, though, all my friends wanted to go to some random Halloween party at some person's house I didn't know. And in my head, I was like, but what if we just stayed here? But I just went with it because, I don't know. I could have stayed at the dorms. They weren't forcing me or anything. I just already knew what was gonna happen. They're all gonna split up and I was gonna end up following one friend around like an idiot. And that's exactly what happened. I don't understand how people can just go to a party where they don't know anyone. Like, they're not even technically invited. Their friend is going, so they just came along too. And they can leave being best friends with everyone and all of a sudden being in a relationship. How? I can't even try to initiate a simple conversation with someone without overanalyzing the freak out of everything. I should talk to someone. Wait, what's their personality like? Are they outgoing? Do they even like talking to new people at parties? What do I even say? I hate small talk. No, don't think about that. What's the best way to introduce myself? Should I be friendly or try to say something funny? What's their comedic preference? I don't know what makes them laugh. I don't even know them. I guess I'd know if I talk to them. What do I say after I say the first thing? I don't want to end up saying one thing and all of a sudden it's awkward tension. They seem annoyed. They probably hate me already. I'm a weak person. Scary things are not my forte. The other night I scared myself by accidentally turning the bathroom fan on instead of the light. So you can guess that I don't regularly indulge in spooky movies by my own free will. But last year, my friends all decided to celebrate the Halloween season by watching a scary movie every single night of October leading up to Halloween. I guess. Every night, I was absolutely terrified because I thought I was about to be scarred for life. But after it ended, I was very underwhelmed and disappointed. It's completely based on the specific movies we watched. I know there's undeniably horrifying ones out there that would absolutely destroy me, but even a fragile leaf like me thought the ones that we watched were below par. One example was The Blair Witch Project, which we all know is a huge classic on the old horror movies list. If you haven't seen it, don't waste your time by skipping the video to not hear spoilers. A group of teens gets lost in the woods with their video camera while looking for something spooky. I can't remember what it was, but it's not really that important. They just needed to go into the forest. Then they get lost and wander around in the woods. Sometimes they'd find a pile of rocks and they'd think it's spooky, even though every 7-year-old who plays outside with rocks does that. The one guy goes conveniently insane for a minute and kicks their map into a river, and they get even more lost and wander around in the woods. Then I fell asleep for an hour. Then I woke up and they were still lost and wandering around in the woods. They find an old house and the end. I fell asleep for the majority of the movie and I didn't miss anything when I woke up. I know there's a new remake of it, and that's probably a little bit better, or at least I'd hope so. But I wasn't spooked at all considering all the hype around it. And yes, I know it's special because it's one of the first to do the found footage style horror movie film thing, but I mean, that still doesn't cover the fact that it was boring with failed tension. But I do like The Nightmare Before Christmas. That's a good Halloween movie. I asked on Twitter if you guys thought it was a Halloween or a Christmas movie, and it was way closer than I thought it was gonna be. Even though it's obviously a Halloween movie, people were still adamant comment about the fact that they thought it was Christmas. Now, it's okay to have an opinion, and not many people can change the way you view something. But to all you people who think it's a Christmas movie, you have to be willing to accept the fact that your opinion is actually wrong. It was originally released October 13th, 1993, closer to Halloween, and the director of the movie himself, Henry Selick, actually answered the question in an interview that it is indeed a Halloween movie. Cry me a river and scream all you want. I'm not attacking your opinion. You can see it as whatever you want. It can be St. Patrick's Day for all I care. Just be able to accept the fact that it is literally canon that it's an official Halloween movie. There's enough Christmas movies around anyway. We don't need any more. Let Halloween have a turn. Share a bit. I'm talking about the things like corn mazes or haunted houses. Going along the haunted houses topic, I haven't been in many, but they were all just awkward. It's kind of just a conveyor belt of people walking through a semi-decently decorated area with other people in costumes yelling and groaning at them. Like, it's kind of just courtesy to go, ah, when they come at you, because otherwise it's kind of weird not to do anything else. I'm sure there's really awesome, well-executed ones out there. I'm very willing to accept that fact, but I just don't think that it's worth spending $20 to go out and do. Just my opinion. No harm if you enjoy it. Again, this video is my general neutral view. It's not that I don't like them, I just haven't been to any that amaze me. Of course, how could I not talk about the biggest part of Halloween? Trick-or-treating. Jaden, are you saying you don't like going out with friends in costumes and getting candy? I don't know, it's not like I didn't like it. I always went out and did it, but I was never really super enthusiastic about it. And save your gas, but I'm not the biggest fan of candy either. It's a good treat, don't get me wrong, but I can't handle too much of it. My costumes growing up weren't really the best. I mean, not really the worst either. One of the only costumes I even remember is when I was younger. I was obsessed with the Powerpuff Girls, and I wanted to be Bubbles because she was my favorite. So my mom ordered a Bubbles costume online, and when it arrived, the wig wasn't even a wig. It was this huge cutout foam hat thing. The eyes were these huge dumb glasses that were bigger than my head. The dress was the same fabric as the hair, and it just draped over my entire body like a curtain. It looked ridiculous, but little Jaden at the time thought it was the frickin' bomb. Like, I became Bubbles. The powers were literally bestowed upon me via the tacky $15 costume. I think that was my favorite costume in my trick-or-treating years. So, yeah. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Dating. Not a fan. But you know, dating simulators can be the closest thing there is to dating without actually having to go out and do it for real, which can seem much more appealing to people like me who do not like people. Believe it or not, dating sims are more popular than you think. Don't believe me? Yeah, I guess that's fair. Either way, there's a seemingly endless plethora of different types of dating simulators out there. You can simulate dating anime girls, anime boys, evil anime girls, old rich chicken man, bubbles, birds! Anything you set your mind to, you can date. Virtually. I've never really played or wanted to play dating simulators. The closest thing I've come to developing any sort of connection with virtual beings is being best friends with Chief in Animal Crossing when I was 13, so I decided I want to see what they're like. You know, surely there's a reason the genre has roughly 22 million consumers. I mean, that's a few million short of the entire continent of Australia. You love bugs, but I didn't go out looking to play the generic normal games. I wanted to test the limits of game developers' creativity and find dating sims that were conceptually really out there. First on the table is speed dating for ghosts. As you can guess, we are starting out by dating ghosts. So how it works is you choose a room to go into, you have a few minutes to chat with a ghost until a bell rings, and another one sits down in front of you. There's three ghosts per room, and once you get the chance to chat with all of them, they all do another circuit, you can continue your conversations, and ultimately choose which one you want to go on a date with. I'm greeted by the speed dating receptionist, Fran, who says, "We get all kinds of ghosts here. Nice ones, sad ones, spooky ones. It gets lonely being a ghost." And I say, "I like being alone." And Fran goes, "I've never met a ghost who doesn't need anyone. No one to talk to. It makes sense, all of this. I'm doing just fine, thanks. You don't even want to make a friend?" Nope. And that led to me leaving the speed dating for ghosts event. Well, okay, I guess I can't be myself in these games after all. So I lie, and I'm given the choice to enter one of three rooms. The Room of Palms, the Room of Liars, and the Room of Black. I just went into the Room of Palms. This huge buff jock ghost sits down in front of me, introduces himself as Riley, and proceeds to call me pretty hot for a ghost, to which I reply, slow down there, buddy. And Riley immediately apologizes, and now I feel bad. Guys, I don't think I'm good at... I think I've been choosing nothing but all the wrong answers so far. Riley and I chat a bit, the bell rings, and I meet this old smoking ghost who used to live in Vegas and was part of the Vegas Mafia until they burned her house down with her in it. The bell rings again, and this giant bush ghost sits down. So this is Steph. She's anxious and introspective in a light and charming way. I'll be honest when I say I did really enjoy her conversations, but then you start to realize she doesn't realize she's dead and a ghost. And then the conversation turns more into just trying to hint towards letting her know she's not alive anymore. I started learning Japanese, but there's thousands of kanji characters to learn. You've got an eternity to learn. If only. I'll die before I learn the language. You're already dead. Ha! Yeah, you're right. In a way, we all are just waiting to die. You're dead. Are you threatening me? I'm gonna tell Fran. Steph finally catches on, and then it gets super introspective. You know, I still feel alive. Just dissociated. Ouch! Oof! Whoa! Oh, that one was real out of nowhere. What the heck? You can't recite my own feelings to me like that. Time ran out and the event came to a close. Out of all the ghosts, I wasn't really drawn to any of them enough to want to go on a date. I like Steph, but she's got her own demons to face for a bit. So back to the three rooms I went. For round two, I chose... Room of Liars. First up is a ghost that is apparently very scared of ghosts. When I was alive, I used to be so scared of ghosts. And turns out they were real this whole time? That one was, you know, I feel like there was an overall ceiling going into it with how well that could have gone no matter what. So, you know. Then came Spooky Peter, and I was ecstatic. Oh my god, he's so cool! He died from the bubonic plague, and now he's become a master at spooking people who are still alive. He's an actual legend. I'm blessed to be in his presence. The living people have written books about him. I was getting spooking tips and learning about the mirror world when the bell rang and this shark ghost, Leon, sits down in front of me and leads with, "Wanna make some money?" "Doesn't everyone?" "Exactly. Let's rob a bank." So I meet up with Leon at the place he told me. I was a little bummed I couldn't chat more with Spooky Peter, but when someone invites you to join them in robbing a bank, how can you say no? You put everything on hold. We were getting ready to go in and we're chatting with Leon's bank robbing buddy, Carlsbad, who is explaining how he works at the bank we were about to rob so he can open the safe and knows where all the security cameras are pointed. When... Spooky Peter! Leon recruited Spooky Peter to join the bank rob crew from the speed dating event as well. I'm nothing less than ecstatic, and my mental health is at an all-time high, which is the ideal circumstances for bank robbing. We get into the safe thanks to Carlsbad, and unfortunately, there wasn't a huge pile of money like Leon was hoping, like in the cartoons and movies. But we were able to open a deposit box that had some lawyer documents in it and a 14-karat gold vanity mirror set. I gave the mirror to Spooky Peter. That was about all the time we had before we had to scram out of there. And even though it wasn't a huge pile of money, I think it was a pretty successful bank robbery. We took something from the bank. That's what else do you want? And I got to see Spooky Peter again. So, since I technically didn't go out on a date with anyone from the liar's room and robbed a bank instead, that leaves... one room left to find my spooky ghost partner. Everyone in the Room of Black was very nice. There was a punk rock skater kid just looking to have fun with a new friend, a nice old pollen lady who makes jam for the living, and Gary.
Hello? I'm gonna narrow my own eyes at you. Oh my god. Okay. Hello? No! Bed breath?
please. Ah! I'm so sorry. Oh my god, this is embarrassing.
I learned Gary's a vengeful ghost who was murdered at his office job, but doesn't remember how, why, or who did it. So naturally, I go along with him to find his murderer and avenge his soul. Turns out Gary was the murderee and stabbed his work partner and then was shot by the police. Well, he was very nice to me. Speed dating for ghosts. I made a lot of friends, but no virtual ghost could win my heart. So let's move on to the Ratchler. You know how the Bachelor works. This is just that. In rat form. I've been told these violet eyes of mine are more purple than all the lavender in the world, and I certainly smell better too. Ooh, you talk a lot. Dear, I can't say that I recall you mentioning it, but how'd you say you scored on the SATs? I got a 1570, which is quite good, if you didn't know.
Wow, you're so different. You wanted to hear more about my work?
Yes, sometimes I host Saturday Night Live and also Wheel of Fortune and Dancing with the Stars. Ever seen Avengers by Marvel? I was the Avenger.
Wow.
Meep. Meeple.
Wow, you're so different. It's time you meet my children. Reggie997, Evangeline, Esquire Jr., Sharpie, and Trashcan. They already love you.
Yuck. If you want my respect, you need to earn it. My whole life, I've had to make do by myself and work for what I've got. And every time I've needed help, people let me down. Yuck.
Honestly, as much as I enjoy being here on the Ratchler, I can't wait to get back home so I can keep teaching my baking class at the local youth center. The kids are so sweet. Next up, I'm teaching them all to bake cheesecake. I hope you can come with me. I could bake you a cheesecake. The kids would love you.
You talk a lot. I ended up proposing to three salamanders dressed up as a rat. Alright, what's next? Dating a dog? Sure, why not at this point? Would you like to see my collection of newts?
No. What's your ideal starting Pokemon? I'm way more Digimon, to be honest.
Would you like to hear a joke?
I hate jokes.
Pipe down and listen up. What do you call an alligator in a vest?
An investigator. I never want to see you again.
So I've tried dating ghosts, rats, dogs. What else is there at this point?
You're right. Namco video game characters. When I found out this sim lets you date Namco characters, I immediately thought of Figar from Dig Dug. I just think he's really cool. I don't think they'd put Figar in there, but Dig Dug is part of the cast, so I started getting my hopes up that I could get to know Dig Dug. So in the game, you play as a shy, awkward cousin from Katamari Damacy who attends Namco High. You end up being put in detention for rolling up desks, the entire marching band, cars, Principal Dig Dug. Wait, he's the principal? Yeah, that's not gonna work. So now I'm bummed and on the verge of quitting the game. What's the point in playing if neither Dig Dug or Figar are romantic interests? But in the cast of characters in the detention room I could talk to, one stuck out to me. Galaga Ship. And suddenly it's all worth it again. I go up and try to talk to Galaga Ship, and naturally they're surrounded by all the popular characters. They're talking about the school play and how they all think Galaga Ship is perfect to play Juliet. And thus began my plan to get into the school play to Romeo Juliet kiss Galaga Ship. I have the option to talk to other characters, and I just go, no, I'd rather sit here and do nothing until the end of detention. And that's exactly what I did. The next day was the little school festival to show off all the clubs and stuff. Naturally, I went straight for the drama club and found Galaga Ship manning the booth. I want to join. Auditions are in the auditorium. I want to be Romeo. Read your lines. Alas, that love. Whose view? Romeo's understudy. Bam! Good enough. Now I have an excuse to practice lines with Galaga Ship, who did land the Juliet role because they're perfect in every way. The story moves along and I meet up with Galaga Ship to rehearse our lines. Well, their lines. You know, understudy. But Principal Dig Dug finds us in the auditorium and thinks we're skipping class for some reason and gives us both double detention. So the obvious next step for me was to sneak onto Galaga ship's property at night and discreetly start apologizing for getting them into double detention. But then their parents find us being secretive and suspicious and ban me from ever talking to their child ever again. It starts raining. Then Pac-Man, who has not been a character in this story at all up until this point, shows up and tells me to be true to myself. Okay, I go home. The next day at school, we find out suddenly Pac-Man has been kidnapped by evil Namco High. I don't even know where the story is going anymore. Galaga ship and I team up and beat everyone up, I think. Like all the students and teachers. We rescue Pac-Man, and that's the end. The end. I'll be honest, that one was a bit... I think it lost me there. You'd think a game where you can date Galaga ship would have a clearer story. After all the dating simulators I just went through, I think I feel weird. Were they all fun? Yeah, I'd say so. But yeah, maybe going for the strangest ones. I guess I got what I asked for. Either way, it was a nice experience. I believe I understand the appeal of dating simulators. It is unfortunate I didn't end up finding my perfect virtual relationship, but hey, there's plenty of ones and zeros in the sea. But I do not think I will be casting my line again anytime soon. However, I could go for another bank robbery.
People are so complicated that most of us don't even understand our feelings and thoughts half the time. Yet, here we are, 7.5 billion of us stuck on this rock, having to interact with each other, everyone with different goals and values and beliefs, and we all gotta try and get along. And also, some people have knives and no emotional reaction to murder. But that's not the point. When I say relationships, I'm talking about any type of interaction between people. Friends, family, colleagues, when you do the kisses with someone. Red flags are a term that everyone's familiar with. That person cheats on everyone they've been with? Red flag. That person only uses people for their personal benefit? Red flag. That person doesn't wipe off the knife after spreading butter on toast, and when they go for more butter, little crumbs get stuck in the tub? Red flag! But what about red flags that only start revealing themselves once you've built trust with someone and have a connection with? When your opinion of someone is positive, those flags can start being overlooked, or you start saying, oh, but they're a good person. I trust them. Oh, I mean, they wouldn't want to hurt me on purpose. It's easy to rationalize warning signs of a bad relationship when you have a positive view of someone, but it doesn't mean that they're not there or should be ignored. They're still being a jerk. It's just complicated by your history together. I think the majority of people tend to be too nice or passive or overly understanding. It's really common and easy to do. Because of that, toxic relationships are much more prevalent than you'd realize, and it can be difficult to know what to look for. There's a chance you're in a hurtful relationship right now and don't even realize it. The term manipulation gets thrown around a lot, and because of that, I think a lot of people would feel they would be able to identify manipulation if it happened to themselves. But it's not as easy as, Chad and Sally are dating. Sally wants to go out with friends. Chad forces Sally to stay home with him. Chad's a manipulator! Yeah, that's actually a super common manipulative situation. But the way manipulation works is that it builds up slowly over time and is almost entirely emotional. Chad might instead start isolating Sally from her friends by nitpicking things he doesn't like about an individual person at a time. I don't like how Nick talks to a lot of girls. That's kind of weird. Don't you think Dawn drinks too much? That's not too responsible of her. Little implants like that can make Sally view her friends not as highly one by one and start trusting Chad more. A few months of this go by and Sally's not hanging out with any of her friends anymore and Chad successfully isolated her, which means he has much more control over her thoughts and emotions. You still might think that's easy to see through and some people are better at picking up on warning flags than others. I think it's important to keep in mind that everything in real life is much more humanized than when we talk about them. For example, we're raised to believe that drugs are awful. It's pretty much brainwashed into us. You're at a party, the lights are blaring, and someone comes up to you and goes, hey kid, wanna do a drug? Time slows down, the cigarette is glowing with evil energy. You look up, and all of a sudden they've grown horns and fangs, and oh my god, it's Satan! No, that's not what happens. Realistically, you'd be at a small get-together with close friends. You've had a nice night with them so far, laughing and having a good time just like normal. One of them just takes out a little sandwich baggie and is like, hey, I've got Coke. There's no time slow-mo or sirens. It's a completely normal feeling situation and all of a sudden your brain is confused. Drugs are bad, but this is my friend. We've known each other since fifth grade. He's just a normal dude. He's not bad. Are my other friends gonna do it?
Your brain thinks of any excuse it can to rationalize behavior from people you trust or think highly of, which applies to relationships. It can be difficult, but you need to define how people should treat you and respect yourself enough to not let people maneuver you into bad situations. Emotionally abusive and manipulative relationships are super frickin' common, and it's tricky because they jostle with your head feels and can make you feel like a squashed fly in a window. Stuck, powerless, sad. If fly corpses even feel sad. I mean, I guess they're just dead. Emotional blackmail is a way to control or manipulate someone by using guilt, fear, and obligation against them. Is someone passive-aggressive, overly controlling? Do they use threats like, do this or I'll hurt you? Or even, do this or I'll hurt myself? That leads to another difficult situation. If someone ever belittles themselves, I'm pathetic. You should just leave me. I'm gonna hurt myself. It puts you in a complicated position, because it can feel like there's a responsibility to provide this person with whatever they need, because obviously you care about them, and you don't want them to feel this way, or even do something bad to themselves. But this is a hard pill you've gotta just swallow. You are not personally responsible for anyone's happiness. But they've got really bad self-esteem, and I'm worried that not responsible for anyone's happiness. But they're really depressed and can't help it, so I feel like if I just not responsible for anyone's happiness. But I'm Santa Claus. Alright, gray area. Responsibility shouldn't be assigned to you, even if it breaks your heart to step back. People normally aren't equipped to be able to help someone with their issues anyway, so it's best to encourage them to see a professional who's been trained to know how to handle things. Someone might be struggling with their own personal stuff, but mental illness doesn't negate their responsibility to maintain a healthy relationship. It just means they need to work on themselves, which is okay, but you don't need to be a part of that. You've got your own junk, they've got their junk, you need to decide how much of their junk you want to help with. Don't let them forcefully shove their junk on you. I like to imagine I'm my own little ecosystem, and I do my best to maintain it every day. If there's a person or a relationship I have that just feels like pollution in any way, maybe it started off well, but slowly started feeling damaging, then I've gotta just step back and ask myself if I need to kick them off my planet. It sounds harsh at first, but you really can't drop your responsibility to maintain your ecosystem in hopes to improve someone else's. Who's gonna watch your ecosystem? No one. Because that's your responsibility. Communication is the most important way to know if you can work on fixing the relationship or need to cut it. Hey dude, can you stop dumping toxic waste into my ocean? You've been doing it for a while and all my cute little dolphins are dying. Oh geez, I didn't even realize I was hurting them. I'm sorry. What can I do to be better? Not only have you communicated that there's a problem, but the person takes full responsibility and is willing to work on getting better. But if they say, look, how was I supposed to know? I was just trying to help. Why are you being so sensitive? That's toxic as shit! Shifting blame, gaslighting, guilt-tripping, catch this deportation. Let them know how they're affecting you, set boundaries on how much you can give, and make sure you both have your own support systems so you don't have to just rely on each other. If things don't change, look at your behaviors as well. Do you feel like you need to justify or explain their actions too much? Do other people you trust not like them? People can get stuck accidentally blaming themselves or over-rationalizing things that are just not right in the first place. And don't forget that you can also be doing things wrong too. Self-reflect a bit. Verbalize your feelings. Ask yourself, am I being an asshole? Why are you doing things? Out of spite? Anger? Jealousy? It's tough to admit your faults, but it's more important to be 100% real and brutally honest with yourself if you're gonna maintain a 100% real relationship. People who manipulate most often don't realize they're being manipulative. No one wakes up and is like, haha, I'm gonna be super manipulative today. Think about your contributions to your relationships and how they affect things. It's okay to admit when you've messed up. It's more messed up to turn a blind eye and keep being a jerk. It takes a lot to break off any sort of relationship because it can feel like a defeat or like you've given up, but sometimes that's just straight up the best and healthiest solution for both of you. Two people can be great, but just not mix well together. And if you feel like leaving is dangerous for either you or them, ironically, that's a pretty strong reason to leave in the first place. Someone shouldn't ever need you. They should want you. Your ecosystem should be able to sustain itself, and relationships are just the little sprinkles of fertilizer benefit for it. If you feel like you're not strong enough to break something off, a good way to work on that is to build confidence. Build a good support system, journal your thoughts, practice positive self-talk.
I am a god.
All right, not that positive. Treat yourself as a friend. It's not selfish to want the best for yourself, especially when someone's over here being a happiness vampire. When you break something off with someone, remember why things didn't work. Repeat it in your head if you need to. A lot of people try and rekindle relationships when the initial problem hasn't been fixed. People need time to change. You don't owe someone a second chance if they haven't put in the work to fix anything. And you can't force someone to get help. If you're unsure about a relationship, think about these questions. Do you put off seeing or responding to them? Do you feel worse after spending time with them? Have they threatened you or themselves in any way? Do they make you feel like you can't do things on your own, or you can't make a single decision without them? Do they ask for a lot of favors or money and don't pay it back? Do they talk badly behind your back? Do you feel like you're walking on eggshells around them? Do they put you down? If it's a yes to more than one of those, then you should start considering either ending it or try to communicate and resolve the problems. Don't tolerate any pollution. You're the one who has to live in it, and you deserve clean air.
Okay, before I even say anything, let's lay out some ground rules. This is probably gonna be the most open I'll ever get about my personal life. I know I've shared tidbits of myself and life through little stories, but when it comes to personal stuff, I'm very private. Especially within the past few years. I'm gonna be talking in very general surface level terms because specific personal details are for me to know, and in the nicest way possible, none of your business. Basically, this is something I want to talk about, share, and bring a spotlight to. But at the same time, you get the Cliff Notes version. So no trying to assume or guess anything beyond what I'm sharing within this video. At the end of the day, we're all just strangers refusing to listen to the stranger danger rule. Alright, formalities aside, let's get into it. I've come to realize that I'm Aro-Ace, which stands for Aromantic Asexual. And I know what you're thinking. That's not gay. What the hell is that? And you know what? That is completely fair, because I didn't know what that was either. Aromantic and asexual are two different things, and I'm gonna break them down to you separately, starting with aromantic, because no one really knows what that one is. And also, it's my personal favorite. Someone who's aromantic is defined as a person who feels very little to no romantic attraction to anyone at all. So, like, they might not develop crushes on people, or feel the need to be in a romantic relationship with anyone. Very general terms, but hopefully you kinda get the gist. If not, here's a little story example from me. Growing up, I never developed crushes on anyone. I remember when I was in fifth grade, kids were talking about their crushes left and right, and it was starting to feel like something I had to experience too, just because I thought that's just what happens. Don't make fun of 9-year-old me, I was a sheep. Anyway, I decided I needed to have a crush because that's just what happens to people. And I very robotically chose this random kid in the class who we can call Pikachu. That's not his name. He didn't mean anything to me and I didn't do anything about this crush. Like, I didn't tell anyone or anything. It was just a headcanon thing for me to feel up to speed and like I was hitting my normal human emotions quota. But it's funny because on Valentine's Day, you know how in elementary school everyone would bring cheesy Walmart Valentine's cards for everyone in the class, and then you'd have a box full of candy and hollow emotions from everyone. Well, my school did that. When I went through my box, I pulled out Pikachu's Valentine and thought to myself, someone who has a crush on someone would keep this. I think. So I put Pikachu's copy-paste Batman Valentine in my drawer and promptly forgot about it because it meant nothing to me, but hey, that's just what I thought I was supposed to do. Man, I'm so good at this. Then like a year or so later when my mom was going through my room, she pulled out the card and was like, why do you have this? And I was like, honestly, I have no idea. Years passed, I entered junior high and thought to myself, alright, this is the time where people start developing crushes and then do something about it. Like get into relationships or something. So I was like preparing to be interested in people. On the first day of school, I scoped out the room to see if there was anyone that I thought looked like someone I could develop a crush on. And this was when classes started being divided up into periods, so there were like 6 batches of people I sifted through. But no one caught my eye, and I thought, man, unlucky. Went through the whole school year, next year rolled around, classes changed, I did the same potential crush scoping again, and the same thing happened. I wasn't drawn to anyone at all. Man. Unlucky again! Every year, I thought something would change, especially going into high school when people started actually hitting puberty and were getting conventionally attractive. But my entire school life, grades kindergarten to senior year, which I'm pretty sure is like 13 years, I wasn't interested in a single person throughout any of it. And what's funny was I was thinking, man, what's the deal? Why is no one attractive? And I went to a big high school. There were like 3,500 students there. Surely I am not the outlier in this formula. Why are none of you attractive? By the time I was going to college, I really felt like I had to find someone. It felt like I was falling behind the curve, or if I was gonna find someone, it was gonna have to happen now. I made a lot of new friends, and that's when I thought I developed my first genuine crush. Long story short, in hindsight, no, it wasn't a crush, and I was just wrong. I just met someone who I thought was cool and funny and had a really strong desire to be close to them. But looking back, knowing what I do now, it wasn't in a romantic way. I realized I can get very excited and tunnel vision on people I think are really cool or interesting, and kind of obsess over getting to know them or just want to spend a lot of time with them. But whenever I got into those tunnel vision moments, if I sat down and asked myself if I actually wanted to be in a relationship with them and hold hands or cuddle or kiss, the answer was not really, but if they wanted to, I could go along with it, which I do not think is right. In my very old flirting video, which I refuse to rewatch, I think at one point in it, I said something along the lines of, if you're interested in someone but they just want to be friends, I don't understand why some people can't deal with that. And that was primarily because I didn't realize there was an emotional difference between a crush or falling in love and just being really good friends with someone. So, oops, sorry for the bad take, I think. I really just thought having a crush on someone was wanting to be their number one best friend. Look, I said don't make fun of me. To me, it used to feel like if I was wanting to become friends with someone to that high of a degree, that would be the next step or justify why I wanted to put this much time, effort, and energy into one person. And it didn't feel right or even fair going through all of this with someone and then tell them they're just a friend. I don't know, it just didn't feel like it made sense, even though I really didn't technically see them in a romantic way. I just didn't understand what was going on really, or that there was supposed to be real emotions and instead of a logical understanding of steps. And the fact that I was under the assumption that I was supposed to be interested in people in a romantic way didn't help with anything. I always preferred to stay good friends, but never felt like I could have that, and I worried that if I said no, that we would just start drifting apart, which I obviously didn't want either. It's been a very long journey discovering this about myself. Everything I'm saying has all been extremely subconscious and not understood or defined for many years. I even used to think I was bi or pan for the longest time because I would think to myself, well, bi is being interested in both genders. I don't really care for either, but zero is equal to zero, so I guess I'm bi or pan. I got math involved. If I knew what aromanticism was when I was growing up, things would have been a lot less complicated for me a lot sooner. I think it's mainly because people don't really talk about it or even know what it is or that it's real. Romance and love is the number one most talked about topic on the planet. Everything I've been taught or learned through society is that love and romance is everywhere, everyone feels it, and it's gonna happen to you. Just a funny little note, there was a point where I was listening to some generic romance song on the radio, you know, like all of them, and I just suddenly thought to myself, wait, do people actually feel these things towards each other? Like all these mushy lyrics are real emotions? They're not joking? And that's when I started feeling like something was different. I approached romance under the blanket term thought of, sure, why not? And didn't recognize it was actually a feeling, which might sound stupid, but look, I don't know. No one presented me with any other options. I did a lot of rationalizing. If someone ever expressed romantic interest in me, I would mentally make a kind of logical list of their pros and cons of what a relationship would look like with them based on what I knew about them as a person. I didn't realize there was supposed to be an extra, like, excited feeling, or the fact that you're not supposed to think about it as if it were a business exchange. I understand compatibility is a huge important variable when it comes to sharing a relationship with someone, but at the end of the day, it's still, apparently, still a very emotionally driven thing. And I literally had to make that discovery and teach it to myself. Now, I'm gonna talk about being asexual very briefly, and I'm gonna preface it with, Let's all just be mature about this, alright? We're all pretending to be adults here. I've got my eye on some of you. Behave! Okay, this is definitely treading into uncomfortable personal boundary territory for me, but yeah, I do want to share that I'm asexual too, which is defined as someone who feels little to no intimate attraction to anyone. Look, I know we said we're all adults, but I'm still gonna dance around the vocabulary, alright? Yes, there's a difference between romantic and intimate attraction. Little side note, I will say you can experience romantic attraction to someone but no intimate attraction, or you can experience intimate attraction but no romantic attraction. You can be one and not the other, it's not necessarily a package deal. Most people feel both, and I do not feel either. Anyway, I have never been magnetically attracted to the look or shape of a single person in my entire life, and did not realize it was a real thing until very recently. I'm able to identify when someone looks conventionally attractive, like by textbook definition, but I never realized people are genuinely drawn to people they think are attractive. I didn't know that people could just see someone and be like, wow, they're gorgeous. I would love to get to know that person, or maybe go on a date with them, or whatever else you people do. I didn't think it was real. I thought people were exaggerating or something. I don't know. And I also couldn't believe that some people feel that with multiple people. Or like celebrities, which sounds absolutely exhausting. It ties back to when I was in school, like looking around for people to like. It makes sense now that no one caught my eye because that doesn't happen to me. I was just wasting my time for 13 years. I feel like such a fool. Now, there's an easy assumption to make about asexual people and that they all have zero interest in being intimate with anyone at all, which actually isn't true. Some of them are genuinely turned off by it and some aren't. Some reasons would be that they just don't mind it, or they want to make their partner happy, or enjoy the emotional closeness of it. There's a million different reasons and a million different people. Am I sharing what kind of a people I am? Nope. And you don't know me personally enough in the slightest to be able to try and parasocially analyze where I stand on that spectrum. I'm just here to say I am this. We are moving on. When I stumbled onto the term aroace and started realizing I fall into that category, it helped me feel much more confident and sure of myself. I've read a lot about how people say they felt broken or that something was wrong with them, but honestly, I was the complete opposite. Coming from my very biased perspective, I think aroace is one of, if not the coolest and most confident orientations out there. Not needing a single gram of romantic or intimate validation from anyone is so cool. All you need is yourself to be happy, maybe friends and family too. And birds. The more I came to terms with the fact I'm aroace, the more empowered and capable I felt. But at the same time, I was also starting to feel more alone and isolated. As cool and amazing and unique and awesome as I think it is, it can be really hard for other people to relate to or even understand. Everyone else and their orientations are able to bond and relate to the love and romance aspects, and we're over here like, we don't do that. I don't even know if I'm explaining it very well. It kind of does go against everything everyone's ever been taught about anything. Romance is taught to be a basic assumed emotion, which I do think is a bit misleading. A common argument used against the aroace orientation is that romance and intimacy is what makes someone human. But I mean, I don't know, lots of birds mate for life, which is a better ratio than people. And all animals get frisky. You know, that's just how they became not extinct. It's not an exclusive to humans thing. If I were to guess, I would assume the thing that makes someone human is basic empathy. Like, I'm not an emotionalist monster. I can still love people. I love my family and my pets, just platonically. And I would hope that you're the same. I just don't experience romantic love, which, I don't know, I don't think that's harming anyone. Definitely not me. I'm having the time of my life. I don't think you need to be in a relationship to be happy. And if you don't want to be just on your own, I think there's many types of people in relationships that push the boundaries of what a conventional relationship looks like. Telling someone that they need to be in a romantic relationship to be happy and fulfilled is weird. And then when that person says they're not happy, they're told relationships take a lot of work, and that's just how it goes. And that's also weird. I don't know. I also think it's weird that once someone reaches a certain age, people inherently start thinking it's sad they're not in a romantic relationship, or assume they're lonely and sad. No one thinks a child is sad and lonely just because they're not in a long-term relationship. I don't know. I don't get it. And I also think I'm rambling. At the end of the day, it's all very complicated to talk about these things, especially because I don't know the feelings I'm supposed to be feeling, let alone talk about. I just know for me, the terms aromantic and asexual are able to articulate things I was subconsciously feeling and thinking before I even realized I was feeling and thinking them. I don't plan on talking about this very much, if at all, ever again. I just want to play my silly little video games, maybe tell a story here or there. But I wanted to bring the orientations to the surface and try to get more representation out there, because I thought if I could help more people become more aware of this, then that would be awesome. I was confused as hell for a while and could have used something like this. It's a real thing. You don't have to feel any sort of romance or whatever to be considered a real person. Personally, I think it's really cool and badass. And don't be afraid to look more into aromanticism or asexualism if any of what I said in this video resonated with you to any degree. Like I said, this is all very surface level stuff. They're both much larger spectrums than you'd think, and maybe you fall under some umbrella category with them. I don't know. Or not. Either way, this has all been my personal experience with this stuff. Is there more for me to figure out within it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is. It can get pretty complicated and confusing. Haha, awesome. Will I be sharing any of that with you? Nope, no way, this is all you get. Hope you can understand even just a little of what I talked about. And if not, that's totally fine. I just hope you can be nice. Reading. Books. Libraries. It's all boring. I don't know if that's an unpopular opinion or not. When I was growing up, it was pretty normal. But now I always hear people gush about how great it is to bundle up in a warm blanket with, quote, a good book, while the faint light of the fall evening peeks out of their cracked windows and hits their collection of plants perfectly. They've got a warm cup of chamomile tea they've prepared with the Keurig they use daily, and actually, it's a funny story. They were about to get one at Target because they were on sale, but they received one as a gift instead. What a coincidence! And they have a cat. I'm not saying that in the poetic life you've got going on over there, but I still don't like reading and have a cat allergy. It's kind of complicated. The thought of reading sounds really nice to me. It's supposed to be calming and good for your brain in some sort of way. I don't know how exactly, but people repeat it all the time, so it might be true. But I think I've got some weird reading PTSD from school, because the other part of my brain thinks about how boring and slow and too quiet it's gonna be, and I feel like I have to take notes and memorize things and identify the plot points and know the names and symbolisms in To Kill a Mockingbird. And, oh god, was I supposed to read up to chapter 7 by Thursday or through it? I used to love reading. I still have the strong memory of going to my elementary school's library and being excited to check out the next Geronimo Stilton book because I loved the pictures and fun text they had. They always wrote the word cheese like this. And being able to read books that had more than 10 words on the page was impressive to a 6-year-old. Whenever I found a book I liked growing up, I would read it nonstop. I was able to crush a 300-pager in 2 days, which I don't think is considered impressive anymore, but it was in fifth grade, and look, that was the only self-worth I had, alright? But when school started making us read books by force, it kinda took the fun away from me. I don't like being told what to do with my free time, especially if you're gonna make me read a book written in the 1940s that I need cliff notes to decode, just to realize that all the animals were communists. Also, it's 20% of my grade. I get it, though. What else are we gonna do in English class? We can all understand each other, right? We're speaking English. That's gotta count for something, right? But the more I had to read really cryptic books in my spare time where the symbolism is in the color of the main character's curtains, and I'm not even observant enough to realize they had curtains, led me to not really in having fun and also feeling like an idiot. I like my subtlety like I like my coffee. Splash in my face. How am I supposed to know what the A stands for adultery? I don't know, it could mean a woman for all I know. Asparagus! But all that isn't anything new. Everyone complains about English assignments. Everyone hates reading the Scarlet Letter. Everyone thinks school should die. However, something that also locked in my disdain for reading was my mom. Hi, Mom! Of course, as a parent, you don't want your child to do nothing but play video games all day. That obviously leads to undeniable life failure. So what's the solution? Make them read more. And on paper, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Honestly, I'll probably use that parenting technique too.
when applicable. I think my mom made the obvious good parenting decision. But as the victim here, I believe I fell in the small minority where it had the overall opposite effect. During summer vacation, my mom would always tell me that I needed to read at least 2 books so I don't forget how to read. Whenever my mom would walk in on my brother and I playing Mario Kart together in the living room, she would ask if we've read yet today, which we would respond no, because reading's for chumps. And then she'd lock us in our rooms to be chumps. I started hating reading so much, I would rather do literally nothing than read a book. There were a couple summers where I faked reading entire books because I just didn't want to read that much. There was this one about dragons, I think, called The Secret Country, and I still remember that just looking at the cover would put me in a bad mood because of hatred association. Screw your secret country. When I was being forced to read, I would sit angrily on my bed, open the book, move the bookmark a reasonable amount forward to make it look like I read, and then just sit there for 30 minutes staring at it. It was boring, and I don't know what was wrong with me. I could have had at least a decent time if I just tried to read the dang book, but I guess it turned into a dignity thing. Actually, the ironic part is maybe a year or so later, I decided to restart the same book and give it another shot on my own terms, and I finished it in 2 days. It was pretty good. I did it again with another book called Molly Moon and the Morphing Mystery. It's like the 5th book in this Molly Moon series. It's been a while, so I don't really remember the story, but it's about this orphan who can hypnotize people and has a pug. Anyway, it's funky because I actually read the first few books of the series on my own and remember really liking them. I would read them any chance I got, but as soon as I was forced to read this one, I just decided I'd rather literally waste my time and sit alone rebelling against reasonable parenting. But this time I never went back to read it. I think that might have been the point of no return for me. I think the association of reading as a necessity or some sort of punishment has deep-rooted itself in me, and now I just feel like reading isn't fun or I'm in trouble for something even though I live alone. I've tried listening to audiobooks, but honestly, they make me feel really lonely. I don't know why. It might be the lack of visuals. I like pictures. And also no one else is around. It's the same with music. I've never been a big music person, so whenever I try to sit down and do something while listening to music, it somehow enhances this feeling of being alone and like time is going by slower, which makes me uncomfortable. So I always have either YouTube videos or more recently Twitch streams in the background. I'm still not super used to Twitch yet, but I like Ryukar's stuff. He plays Mario Maker. Sometimes I wish I read more. It might be good for me to slow down instead of always consuming fast-paced content on the internet, but on the other hand, I think it's just a preference I have that's been cemented with bad association. If you like reading, I think that's really great. I've got a lot of friends who like reading, and it's cool that you've got a really nice hobby you can fall back on to de-stress, or however you people feel while staring at words all day. I was gonna say you should recommend a good book I should give a try, but I took a second to think about if I would actually try to read any suggestions, and being real with myself, the answer is no. So, enjoy that chamomile tea.
So James from The Odd Ones Out did a video about his 7-day vegan challenge baby solves all your problems. And if you go to the end of his video, he actually nominates me to do the 7-day vegan challenge baby solves all your problems. If you haven't seen James's video, you should really watch it because he covers some important points in it. But I accept your challenge, James. I will not eat or purchase foods that contain any animal products in it. I give to you all my 7-day vegan challenge baby solves all your problems. So here's a secret. Eating vegan is easy. It's so easy. You might think it's hard, but it's easy. Look, 1/2 cup non-dairy milk, 1/2 cup oats you blend into flour, 1 banana, blend together, boom, breakfast pancakes. Tomato, avocado, cucumber, greens, hummus, sriracha, boom, lunch sandwich wrap, black beans, rice, sweet potato, more sriracha, greens, boom, dinner, boom, food! I thought it'd be boring to post a video of me just eating food for a week, so to actually bring you guys entertainment, James and I bought a bunch of weird vegan substitute foods to try together. So yeah, here's that instead.
Okay. So we bought these vegan-flavored foods.
Yeah.
And we're going to try and eat them.
So I got this veggie burger, and it, like, has no instructions on how to cook them. So we're just going to stick it in the microwave, see what happens.
Do you need scissors?
No. Ugh.
That's a weird texture. There they go.
5 minutes.
Five minutes?
I'm messing with you.
So while those are cooking, in the microwave. We're going to do the bacon. Mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of looks like the same texture as the burgers.
Yeah.
We also, as these things are cooking and stuff, we got these baby things.
Because of the box.
Just because it says vegan and there's a crazy baby on it.
This isn't Photoshop. This baby is actually excited.
This
for
is
these
the
crackers.
Reaction you will have when you eat these crackers.
No dairy, no eggs, no yeast, no salt, no cholesterol, no preservative. This is nothing. You're eating nothing. Yeah.
Whoa, I wasn't expecting that crunch.
Me neither. Babies don't even have cheese. How are these
supposed to
eat this?
Yeah, these are for teething. Do you just like saliva on it? Oh. ASMR?
Not on my top 10 favorite foods. I don't know if the bacon is supposed to look cooked or not.
Is it almost ready? I mean, technically, we're not cooking out any, like, salmonella or anything. We're just heating it up, I guess. We don't know. All the buns that are over there have, like, non-vegan stuff, like cow milk. So we're just going to use normal bread. All right, and then we're going to go crazy, and we're going to put the bacon on it, too.
Mm, a bacon burger.
Yeah, we're putting together the perfect vegan sandwich. Mm. Hey, Jeff.
How do you feel?
I like it.
What do you taste? You shouldn't be tasting any soy or cholesterol. All right, bye, yeah. Jackson.
Only babies can enjoy this. I'm going to close these masterpieces. Is it good?
Yeah.
Is it really good? Yeah, it is good.
Glad I made two.
Yeah, this is our lunch. We just made lunch.
We didn't even have to hunt anything.
Yeah, there's no killing in this sandwich. Just tofu and plants and happiness. We also have bologna.
Bologna. Oh.
Okay, so here's the little package. They're in like little discs.
We're just gonna eat it like this. It doesn't smell like bologna.
It doesn't? What does it smell like? Like peace?
No killing. It actually does kind of taste like bologna though.
Can I try some?
Yeah.
It's making me uncomfortable because it actually does taste like...
But it's pretty spot on.
It's very spot on. Like, a lot of people on YouTube, they say like, oh, we're gonna eat weird vegan food. And it's like, oh, this is disgusting.
But,
I mean, I don't know what they bought, but this is pretty good. We're having a grand time.
We need to start, like, faking our reactions. Oh!
It says, right here, 100% vegan, cholesterol-free, non-GMO,
that thing,
a lot of protein, kosher, and gluten-free. So
what is made out of it? Ingredients.
Plants?
Water. Soy protein. Flip it like woo.
I don't think I can.
I just saw one little If this tastes like chicken, then like why even eat chicken again?
Yeah. Okay, so as these cook,
uh-huh,
we're gonna try these things.
Ooh.
It might have coconut and banana, but it's green, so I'm not sure.
This looks like bird food.
Oh. Look how cute. Okay. Cheers. Mm. Oop.
Oh.
Oh.
I think we found something.
It's like changing as we eat.
Yeah, like a Willy Wonka thing.
Ew, it tastes like a candle.
This is banana and coconut?
Ugh.
I probably look really gross from this angle.
The chicken is warm now, so we're going to make chicken wraps. Mm-hmm. And James is cutting tomato.
Welcome to our vegan house. We should do like a parody vegan cooking show. All right, so what you want to do is you want to dice these tomatoes up. Make sure they're not too thick, not too small. Kind of like this. Very ripe. I'm good. So what you want to do is you want to put the chicken in the wrap and like so. This one needs more. We microwave the bacon, it's really hot. Maybe it's just there, okay.
Look at that. That actually looks good.
Just a big old bite.
Is it good? That face, I can't tell by your face.
The chicken tastes like how I thought it would taste.
Which is?
Not real chicken, but sort of there.
But it's good?
Yeah, it's good.
Rate it.
5 out of 7.
Jax is back for more.
What is it?
It's chicken. Mm-hmm. Without any killing.
There's no
murder in this chicken.
No, this is not just make. This is gonna bring a smile to your face.
No. Come on. There's no murder.
It's better than the other one.
So now that we have all this gourmet food, we're gonna wash it down.
With milk.
With some beverages. So that was the almond milk. Now we're trying rice milk.
I don't know, like, I said 4 out of 10. What did you say it was?
I said 7 out of 10 for that rice milk. Ready? Oh, that tastes like...
vanilla-y.
It's sweet, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, we got vanilla flavor.
Oh.
It tastes like Rice Krispies, and then it tastes kind of weird.
Mm-hmm. So what would you rate it?
4 out of 10.
Really?
Yeah.
So I was about to say 7, so it's...
Really?
Hemp milk. This is the one that you can get high off of, right?
Ooh.
Looks different. Looks great. Like, it looks like you put water and, like, I put a lot in there. And flour.
Let's do it. Oh! Oh my god, it's really bad. Oh my god. Oh my god, it tastes like water.
Water and flour.
Yes, it tasted exactly like you said it would.
How people eat this.
Oh my god, that was the worst one. 0 out of 10.
I was gonna say 1 out of 10, just in case this is worse, I need to do 0 out of 10.
I mean, okay, 1 out of 10.
1 out of 10.
The last one
is... Hit me up.
Oat milk. It's yellower. Uh-huh. And also, like, thin. You know how... Oh!
How did that happen? It has the same color as eggnog.
It does. But... Merry Christmas. Mmm.
Okay, not...
Oh. It tastes like oatmeal if you, like, mm-hmm. ate it and spit it out. 3 out of 10.
Yeah, 3 out of 10.
So,
and now the piece de resistance.
Yeah. What's the dessert that we have on the menu?
It looks like this Reese's Puffs cake. Look at the inside. That seriously is a Reese's cup.
Mm-hmm. I was expecting it to be better.
I'm disappointed. 5 out of 10.
I was going to say 5 out of 10. Mm-hmm. So this is what it looks like to be vegan. Yay!
And that was that. I made it through the 7-day vegan challenge, baby, solves all your problems. I had an optimistic view going into it, and that's probably what gets people the most when they try it. I think the worst part about vegans are really just the stereotypes, which, I mean, yeah, there's gonna be crazy nut jobs out there, but when you think about it, there's crazy nut jobs in all communities. You wouldn't assume that all gay people are flamboyant, or that all Asians are martial art masters that are good with math and chopsticks. People are gonna get triggered if you think like that. Vegans just get stuck with the crazy stereotypes. Jaden, what about the people on YouTube constantly preaching about activism and blah 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 blah? Yeah, they preach because they're activists. They take action. That's activism. Like, okay, step back. When people hear vegan, a common thing to think of is, oh, they won't stop bringing it up that they're vegan all the time. But how often do you actually hear people doing that in real life? It's kind of come to the point where someone can't even say that they're vegan without other people freaking out. Do you want some of this burger? Oh no, I'm good. What? Oh come on, don't be modest, you want some. Oh no, I'm really good, I actually don't eat meat. You don't? No. Why not? I'm vegan. Oh come on, you know I'm exaggerating. Kind of. So, I guess I should challenge someone to do the 7-day vegan challenge, baby, solves all your problems too. Well, I mean, if you want to do it yourself, then go ahead. I'm not going to stop you. But I'm going to nominate Tony V Toons and It's Alex Clark. So yeah, that was that. Thanks for watching. And go eat a sandwich that has no murder in it. Or pasta. Pasta is vegan. Lots of people don't know that. Go eat pasta.
I know absolutely nothing about Digimon. Pokemon is my entire life, so why would I need to branch out? Well, I happen to be a very open-minded person, and the only way to prove that is to play a Digimon game for the first time. I wanted to see if, putting all my bias aside, I could bridge the gap between the two, and they could live together in harmony in my tiny little brain hobby drawer. So thus began my journey on finding the perfect Digimon game to start out with. At first, I didn't think that would be a difficult feat. Every community kinda has the general agreed consensus on what media is best to consume as a newcomer, right? All it takes is a quick Google search, I play what the internet people tell me, and now I'm a Digimoner. Well, apparently not here. I've come to realize that it's a bit complicated for them. Everywhere I looked, there were threads upon threads of people trying to agree on what Digimon game is even good in the first place. Pretty much every comment I read said something along the lines of, "This game is pretty good, yeah, except for these things," or, "This game is great, if you can look past these extremely annoying mechanics." Every time I thought I had a lead on a game, I would look further into it and realize a lot of people actually had a lot of complaining to do. And it wasn't even angry complaining, it seemed like I've walked in on a fandom that has just been hurt over and over, and they're really trying to hang on to something and believe in the good of the franchise, but they've just been put through a lot. you know, kind of like the Sonic fandom. I've never had to do so much research just to find a single game in a franchise that people can just all agree is good. People were talking about how they like Digimon World, but apparently it's like a tedious and frustrating Tamagotchi game where you just start over if they die. Digimon World 2 is apparently a dungeon crawler, but extremely grindy and complicated, and I read a lot of people complaining about it just being bland. People said Digimon World 3 is a typical RPG, but the battles get tiring and annoying, lots of backtracking and never feeling like you get anywhere. Digimon World 4, Digimon World Championship, the list goes on and on, con after con. I spent multiple research sessions searching, even opted for a last-ditch effort by asking, Twitter. Everyone was saying different things. No one seemed to be able to agree that there was just one game that was overall good and easy to start with. And Digimon fandom, if there truly is a good game out there, you guys need to start pitching the franchise better. You made this difficult. I will say it seemed like the majority of people enjoyed Digimon Cyber Sleuth, but the thing is, that's not really the type of game I wanted to play for the channel. It looks like it's got more of a Persona 5 vibe that focuses more on the story and characters and stuff. That's just what I've read, I don't know. Either way, it wasn't the fit for what I'm looking for. I'm sure I would love it as a casual playthrough, but it just didn't hit my content checklist. All this research led me to a game I decided to settle on. Digimon World Dawn. It didn't seem perfect, I saw complaints with it, but I thought, you know, it seemed like the same amount of complaints other Digimon games were getting, and there were enough people talking positively about it. I figured I could look past the criticisms, maybe even if I was aware of them beforehand, they wouldn't bother me too much. And plus, I thought it looked nice. I like the pixel art, and I'm a sucker for good pixel art. So after all that, all the research, knowing the flaws beforehand, having a positive mental attitude, I settled on a good enough Digimon game, right? Something at least playable, right? As much as I want to say yes, this was one of, if not the most miserable video game experiences I've ever forced myself to go through. And that isn't even as a biased Pokemon player, that's as an enjoyer of fun. I was aware of Digimon World Dawn's criticisms, I knew what I was getting myself into, yet despite all the warnings, all the positive outlooks, all of the manifesting to be able to frolic hand in hand with both the Digimon and Pokemon franchises together in a beautiful field of 1,000 sunflowers, it was just awful. It started out lighthearted. I tried to put my name in and realized they only allow 5 characters for the main character's name. So I'm Jaden. Before any gameplay, I'm given 4 different packs of 3 Digimon. The Balance Pack, Attack Pack, Speed Pack, and the Japanese Pack. And honestly, I was shocked to see how huge and powerful they all looked. Look at these big men! Pokemon starters don't look like this. This is awesome! I chose the Attack Pack because the big worm guy was my favorite. And then the game forces me to nickname all my Digimon. It's not an option, and if I try to name them their original Digimon names, I can't, because they don't give me enough characters. Again. Out of everything I read about this game, this is hilariously not mentioned in anyone's criticism list. I don't know if it's a Digimon thing, or I don't know. So here I, Jaden, am with my Charmon, Tony Tiger, and Big Worm. I'm not even given a chance to breathe before I'm thrown into this Digimon gang tournament, having to fight for my Digimon and friends' lives and glory in an environment I'm not even sure how to comprehend. Like, first of all, where are we? This sure doesn't look like the States. Or Japan, I think. Also, what is a Digimon? I win by figuring it out, kind of not really. Still don't know what's going on. And then win a few more times before the tournament is over and our team or gang or something, Light Fang, is the winner. Yay, Jaden! You won the tournament for us! What's going on? Oh my god, what the f- is that? In a complete twist in story direction, a genuinely terrifying virus of death spawns and starts turning all the Digimon into Digi-Eggs. including mine. I checked my guys, and Charmon is the same. Tony Tiger is a bit smaller. But Big Worm is a dinosaur now. He's not a Big Worm anymore. Now his cleverly tailored nickname doesn't make any sense. How was I supposed to know I was getting fully grown Digiguys, and they were gonna turn them back to small Digiguys again, and Big Worm starts off as a lizard? That's like the opposite of how evolution works. I knew I didn't know anything about Digimon, but after the past 5 minutes, I've realized I am completely out of my element. I go up and fight the horrific demon virus that I'm IRL scared of, and despite still not knowing what the hell I'm doing, I end up winning, even with my little digibabies. The virus deuces out, and the head of the Lightfang clan, this Glare guy, that's his name is Glare, is like, "This is so weird. Go climb a mountain and look around or something, I guess." I'm sent out to look for virus clues at Login Mountain and run into my Lightfang friend, Kenpa, who's like, "I don't know what happened. We got here and all the wild Digimon started attacking me and the other members. They left me behind to be mauled with no escape equipment. I'm fine now, but I think I'm just gonna go back to the city." She does that, and I start traversing the mountain. And this is where I experience my first complaint that everyone was talking about in this game. All the dungeons and areas and stuff are mazes. They're all mazes with absolutely bonkers wild Digimon encounter rates. You don't have a mini-map to know where you're going or where you even are any point of the dungeon. And there's no item to avoid the random encounters. Basically, I am realizing this is like playing a Pokemon game, but the whole game is a maze. You never know where you are because maps don't exist. Everything is wild grass, and there's no repels. I think I chose the wrong game. I end up stumbling my way to the top of the mountain. At least I think it's the top. I have no idea where I am and never will. And the other two guys who left a defenseless little girl to be roasted over a digifire are getting beat up by a digi-eagle. I knock the bird in the head hard enough to make him come to his senses, and he apologizes for being mean, which is more than I expected, to be fair. And the guys are saved. By the way, I didn't know that Digimon spoke. I didn't know that they spoke to the people and talked and interacted. It's weird to me, and I never quite got over it. We return to the city, and everyone's like, "Great job, Jaden," and then suddenly I'm left alone with absolutely no idea what to do or how to continue progressing. I'm trying to figure out if I have to, like, talk to someone or walk into the right room, and someone's like, "Ah, Jaden, we're all being traumatically and irreversibly turned into digi-eggs over here," or something, I don't know. And I do want to make sure you guys know that even the main hub is a maze. The amount of time I spent trying to figure out where I even am in the supposed safe space of the city overworld was pure comedy and frustration. Why is everything in this game perfectly designed to try and make me never open my DS ever again? I am just wandering around, walking in what I am 60% sure is a circle, left in the dark on what actions I need to take to keep playing a game I no longer want to play. I look it up and figure out that if I want to progress the story, I need to earn it. I have to walk into this building, talk to the digi-clerks, and complete multiple useless side quests that have nothing to do with anything to unlock another chunk of the main game. And let's not forget, all the dungeons are mazes! I said that already, but I want to reiterate. I have to go through mazes, sometimes multiple times, to unlock the important maze. But only for a little bit, after I earn just a biscuit, just a crumb of that sweet, sweet story nectar. I'm humbled yet again by being told to go play more errand boy in more pointless mazes as the cycle continues. Surely this game is not serious. Surely this game didn't get an overall average to decent rating on multiple game review sites. Surely the people who said this game was pretty good, all things considered, were secret enemies hoping to pull innocent victims into their dark, dark digiweb, looking to either break the weak or torture the strong. What is going on? Am I the only one who thinks this game was meant to be given to hostages to torture information out of them? I'm 3 hours in, and I'm straight up ready to spill my mother's maiden name. And I still don't even know how to play the thing, or what a Digimon is, because no, I do not want to read a Bible's worth of tutorials. I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna be the first person to use a Nintendo DS to kill a man. Let me cut this whole show short and just tell you the entire non-fluff plot of the game. Evil Fountain of Youth of Death virus turns all the Digimon into Digi-Eggs. Lightfang Clan thinks Nightcrow Clan is behind it because their chief is acting strange. Nightcrow Clan thinks Lightfang Clan is behind it because their chief is acting strange. The two realize neither of them are behind it because they've been mind-controlled to act strange. They find out there's an evil Digimon virus thing behind it all. Jaden beats it up. It fades away, and credits roll immediately. Bruh. How long did it take me to experience that story? 15 in-game hours. And I was cheating! I was using speed-up, and EXP codes, and guides, and ibuprofen. That time could have easily tripled if I was being a good little squeaky clean angel playing the game in its purest, most intended form. But if I did that, I would have thrown myself into the ocean. And even using all the resources I could find, it still was not a fun experience. Here's a clip of me trying to read a guide after my fifth time of being completely lost in a maze dungeon.
If you've unlocked the macro sea, go there and head south, then go up and right to head to the south path leading to another screen, then go left after another screen, then go to the big bridge looking thing on the left. If you don't have the key, head south. Oh my god.
I didn't understand any of that.
I'm freaking out, dude. Not only was I subjected to maze after maze after maze, wild encounter after wild encounter, but throughout all of that, the game still expected me to do a cement mixer amount of grinding. No way, Jose! Do you know how many layers deep this agony cake is already? You want more? Sir, I am but a husk. As you can see, there's not a molecule of serotonin, dopamine, or endorphins in this lifeless body. There is nothing left for you to take. You have created a human raisin. I'm really sorry, Digimon fans. I really have nothing against Digimon as a whole. In fact, I absolutely loved a lot of the Digimon designs. When it comes to monsters and creatures, I have to admit, I am an edgy bitch. So I absorbed those guys like they were a little puddle of muddy water in a scorching barren desert. Because metaphorically speaking, that's what they really were to me. Look at all these fellas! I'm surrounded by everything I could ever want in a monster. Pokemon could never. Maybe Aggron. I even got Big Worm back. He's my friend forever. Despite all my efforts, I chose the wrong Digimon game. I really did try. I'm sorry I didn't play Cyber Sleuth. I didn't know the other option was 1,000 punches to the skull. Regardless of the pain this game has inflicted on me, I can, against all odds, say I am coming out of this experience a bit of a Digimon enjoyer. Maybe I still don't know a single thing about any of it, but I have some favorite guys. I think they're cool. This evil, evil game somehow didn't tarnish my view on Digimon as a franchise. I am damaged, but I forgive. One day I will play Cyber Sleuth and hopefully be able to commit to being a fully fledged Digimon fan. That's how I think it works. Until then, Digimoners, I'm worried about you. Please seek therapy.
Hey guys, do you remember Kate from Embarrassing Moments Number 1? She was with me when I was making a fool of myself.
Hello.
Well, she works at a popular frozen yogurt place and has some pretty crazy customers with some pretty funny stories. And I wanted to share one of her stories with you all. Everyone say hi to Kate.
Hi, Kate. Okay, so it started when an old man and his elderly family and friends walked into the store. Now, a little background on yogurt handling. Every night at 8:15, one of the employees has to clean and drain one machine that holds a yogurt flavor.
This means that customers can't order that flavor for the rest of the night. My coworker, we'll call him Kevin, was over draining the salted caramel flavor, which just so happens to be the most popular yogurt flavor. Since Kevin was over handling the machine, I was the one who had to take the customer's orders. Hello, what can I get you?
Give me some of those salted caramels.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir, but we're draining that machine tonight. Is there another flavor you'd like instead?
What? But you had to go and drain my flavor first, huh?
Oh, no, sir. That's the only machine we're draining tonight.
But yeah, you took away my flavor first.
I looked over at Kevin, who was overhearing the old man's nonsense. We made eye contact, like, what the heck? And he walked over to the old man and started explaining why he had to drain the machine, emphasizing the fact that we only have to clean out one machine a night.
B- Bet you had to go and drain my flavor first.
By this time, we figured that the old man was just crazy, and there wasn't any way we could reason with him, so we stopped trying to explain. Then Kevin started suggesting other flavors he might enjoy other than salted caramel.
Is the vanilla any good? I want that.
Okay. Then after the old man's group finished their order, they all grabbed the yogurt and walked outside. Did you ring anyone up? They all left pretty quickly.
No, did you?
No. Turns out they all left the lovely old man to pick up the entire check by himself. Serves him right. After figuring out all the costs of each order, Kevin says,
okay, so your total is going to be $27.89.
Are you lying to me, Kevin?
What?
You made it extra expensive, didn't you?
No, sir, I wouldn't do that.
Is he telling the truth? Because I got a feeling. I don't like that look.
No, sir, you can trust Kevin. He's very trustworthy. Kevin started trying to explain even more, but the old man cut him off again.
I don't trust ya.
Okay.
So now, it was just me and the old man. So your total is $27.89.
Thank you, Kate.
While paying, he tried to make a little bit of pleasant conversation with me, as if that whole dramatic situation didn't even occur. And then he gave me a tip.
Yeah, just make sure that the dimwit co-worker don't get none of that cash, all right? Kate, you earned it. That's just for you.
Oh, thanks, sir. Have a nice day.
Okay, you too.
And then he walked away.
So basically what the moral of the story is old men can take their frozen yogurt very seriously. So be careful out there, everyone.
Virtual pet games have been around since when people figured out how to make games that weren't Pong. Tamagotchi, Nintendogs, Webkinz, RoboSapien, you name it. And it makes sense. Kids love pets, and parents love not giving their children actual living, breathing animals that'll eventually die and send their child into a spiraling depression for at least 3 days. It's a win-win for everyone. In 2004, my parents gave me a Nintendo DS along with two games to go with it. Animal Crossing Wild World and Nintendogs. They already gave me a real dog at that point, but this was good for stopping me before I started trying to ask for another, because boy did I not take care of the first one. I actually still have the exact same save file as when I first got the game. This is Star, my first ever Nintendog. I don't know why I named her Star, especially since the shape on her stomach is a heart. Anyway, her stats are maxed out. She can walk longer than any of my other dogs. I was gonna show you, but then... I do not think that we just went on a walk. I haven't seen these dogs in 12 years, and she's the champion of agility training. Or, at least she was, until I tried to do a contest like the good old days, made a fool of myself, and got my dog bullied by the judges. This is Scruffy, named after my childhood dog, who is very dead now. Oh, there's Scruffy. I know you haven't had a human interaction in like 6 years because you're dead, but give me some space, will ya? And the other dogs mean nothing to me. I also wanted to show off my peach cart toy. I loved this thing as a kid and thought it was super rare, which I actually think maybe isn't because I have two. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about Nintendogs. I'm here because I found a bunch of very strange virtual pet games that are not Nintendogs that I want to show you. First up, we've got Hamster's Life with a Z. And, I got these games from eBay and it looks like someone else's hamster is on here. Anyway, oh no, it's one of these games. So I was going through the selection of hamsters and I stumble onto this. The Cutie Hamster. This is quite possibly one of the ugliest hamsters I've ever seen in my entire life. The cute little icon compared to the actual hamster is astounding. It got worse. He looks like an elder, so I'm going to name him Grandpa. Oh, Grandpa wants to play a memory game. Oh no. So you can pet your hamster, feed it, clean the mass amounts of black mold growing in its cage. Hold it with your creepy hand. You can even take him out of the cage and hold it. Alright, I think I'm done for now. You can also give it toys to play with. Oh, he cages too small. So, you know, Hamster's Life with a Z was as to be expected. Sure, some of the execution was a bit unexpected.
but nothing out of the ordinary. Until, what do you say when you turn around, you see a cat, and your heart almost stops? What? I thought you just play little mini-games with your hamster and feed them seeds and stuff, but apparently they start learning English. You can talk to them, and they'll respond, but you can only say the options the game has provided. Ah, yes, the only phrases a human would ever need. Good evening, come on, and I'm sad. But sometimes the hamster will personally ask how to convey emotions. My friend went away. How should I express these feelings? What should I say when I only have one sunflower seed left? Guys, I taught my hamster how to be sad, and now I think he's depressed. But it's okay, because 42... 42-